You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Greg Grandin, who is the author of a number of prize-winning books, including The Empire of Necessity, Slavery, Freedom, and the Deception of in the New World, which won the Bancroft Prize in American History, and Fordlandia, The Rise and Fall of Henry Ford's Forgotten Jungle City. Grandin is a professor of history at NYU and a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. We will be discussing his new book, The End of the Myth, From the Frontier to the Border Wall in the Mind of America. Greg Grandin, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on. The End of the Myth is a terrific book, which I highly recommend, although I listened to the audiobook rather than reading the hard copy, so I don't have my usual pile of notes written down about it. Why don't we start with the basic idea? What is the myth that has ended?
Well, the myth is the myth of the frontier, and the frontier itself is a symbol for a larger element of American history, and that's expansion. You know, both the social experience of expansion, which was built into the United States even before its founding as a nation, the idea of moving west, the idea that being able to kind of pull up stakes and head out onto the frontier would solve social problems, would prevent the concentration of wealth, would dilute what later would become class conflict, that would disperse extremism and factionalism, that would allow for a unique kind of a U.S. politics that elevated the political center while marginalizing the extreme. It was a social experience of expansion, and then there was the mythology of expansion, the way that experience was turned into an ideology, and there's different expressions of that. But in the late 19th century, Frederick Jackson Turner, an historian at the University of Wisconsin, gave a paper at a Chicago World's Fair in 1893, and he talked about the significance of the frontier in American history, and that kind of coalesced and consolidated a lot of different diverse and dispersed ideas about what it was that it was about the United States that was exceptional. So that's the myth. And I could go talk quickly about why it's ended, but we could leave that for another question.
No, please go ahead. Why has it ended?
Well, the impetus for the book, the prompt for the book was when Donald Trump announced for his presidency in 2015, and he said he was going to build a great, great wall on the southern border, and it struck me that the opposition of those two things, the open, limitless frontier symbolizing the United States as moving out into the world, as Frederick Jackson Turner would have it, the kind of central icon of American exceptionalism, was being upended by Donald Trump. It was being supplanted by a new national symbol, and that was a border wall. And as that wall came to symbolize, whether it gets built or not, all of the different expressions of Trumpy, what has become Trumpian nativism, what some scholars call a race realism, a sense that the United States has to take care of its own, it has to close its borders. And so that opposition between those two things was worth exploring. And the argument of the book is that what explains Trump, you know, Trump could either be understood and has been understood either as something wholly exceptional to U.S. history, an unprecedented violation of a long history of openness and tolerance and fitful progress, or the fulfillment of this bloody history of settler colonialism. I think that you can't really, I think that opposition needs to be situated within this larger context of U.S. expansion and what is the end of the frontier? The war in Afghanistan and Iraq, the collapse of the free market economic growth model, the deepening of inequality and the consolidation of social immobility, and hanging over it all, climate change, a real sense that the United States has, that the world is hitting these new limits, has led to the collapse of the viability of the frontier as a national symbol and the rise of this new symbol, the wall. So the argument is basically very simple, that Trumpism is what happened when the empire ends and when the frontier closes.
I think it's very well said, and it's very well said in the book, and I don't disagree with it. But let me ask a little bit of a devil's advocate sort of question here, and I imagine you agree with me, that Trump is not completely new, that opposition to immigration, that borders and racist violence at borders, as described in the book, is not new, and that Trump has actually escalated several foreign distant wars, put more troops in more bases in more countries, etc. So Trump is not a brand new reversal of American expansionism.
Yes, absolutely. And that's what I meant by saying that that opposition between these either something entirely new or the fulfillment of a deep-seated brutality and nativism, it doesn't obscures more than it reveals. The U.S. has all of these expressions of Trumpism, the violence, the nativism, the, all of the brutality and extremism that's involved in moving forward in the world was always present. But that's the key to the argument. As long as the frontier remained open, as long as the United States was able to vent that extremism outward or marginalize it at the fringes, then it never came to national power. I mean, certainly we've seen nativist movements like Trump before, right? We've seen George Wallace, we've seen Father Coughlin during the Depression. You know, you can go back but extremism of the right wing kind of the kind of the deep white supremacism that is inherent in the foundation of the United States, a nation founded on chattel slavery, a nation founded on ethnic cleansing, a nation founded on dispossessing a third of national territory from Mexico. That white supremacism, which was always present, was also always contained and marginalized at the extreme. As long as the frontier remained open, as long as expansion remain viable, as long as politicians could point beyond the frontier and answer social demands with the promise of limitless growth. As soon as that ended, I say it ended, not in any one moment, but certainly it was a series of the exhaustion of the neoliberal project, the series of the exhaustion of the neoconservative project, the exhaustion of the limitless capitalist extraction model with climate change. As soon as that ended and politicians could no longer use the promise of limitlessness to organize domestic politics, what is now Trumpism moves from the margins and takes national power. So that's what's different this now. And you're right. In terms of the second part of your question, Trump just vetoed vetoed an attempt to end the U.S.'s support for the war in Yemen. We could point to any number of ways in which Trump has just kept his foot to the throttle in terms of deregulation, in terms of austerity, in terms of the Republican agenda on nearly every level. And the wall serves as a way to distract and divert because there's a way of thinking about the wall as representing a kind of disenchantment with liberal universalism, a more honest way, because we have hit a limit. And so the wall is just a recognition of that. But it's its own illusion, exactly in the way that you've just described in your question, because it allows the whole thing. It creates the illusion that we could keep going as we are as long as we just build the wall. The wall is a way for Trump to talk about capitalism and its pain, the pain and misery of capitalism, without actually challenging the fundamentals of capitalism.
The book has a very interesting description of safety valve, of what a safety valve actually is, and of the various metaphorical uses, some of which you clearly have just been endorsing in this conversation, as well as in the book. Can you talk a little bit about this idea of the safety valve through U.S. history?
Yeah. So the safety valve was an actual mechanical thing that was invented in the 17th century that allowed steam to be vented and eventually became technology improved, and then it was used on steamboats, on railroads, on boilers, and it moved into political discourse in the United States as a metaphor to talk about the venting of social tension around the 1830s. And the point in the book, and everything I'm talking about could be understood in terms of metaphor of the safety valve, but I actually do talk about the specific metaphor of the safety valve in the book in one chapter. The point of the safety valve is not that everybody, no matter what your position is, whether, say, in the 1830s you thought that workers should have the vote, or you thought that workers shouldn't have the vote, or you thought that slavery should be ended, or you thought that slavery should be reformed, whatever your particular political position, you could invoke the metaphor of the safety valve. In other words, expansion was the answer to every problem, and there was no problem created by expansion that couldn't be solved through more expansion. And that's the power of the safety valve. And just to bring it back to the United States again, when you think of what is exceptional about the United States, and that phrase, American exceptionalism, has many different meanings and can be defined in different ways. One thing that is exceptional, that no other nation, and frankly, very few even open and out empires had, was the privilege of being able to use constant expansion, first continental expansion, then expansion to war and all of the kind of missionary moralism and that's involved with wars from the War of 1898 forward, and then the expansion of markets, the idea of globalization. The United States, it's been no other nation has so centrally organized itself around the need. I mean, early founders and second generation founders basically talked about expansion as if it was a check, as if it was one of the checks and balances built the Constitution. They openly understood that the United States could not maintain its small sense of limited government if it didn't expand. That property rights, this absolutist commitment to property rights and individual political rights, as opposed to social rights, was absolutely dependent on the United States' ability to move outward, to extend the sphere, as John Madison said.
We're speaking with Greg Grandin, by the way, whose book is The End of the Myth, From the Frontier to the Border Wall in the Mind of America. In terms of expanding beyond settlements to foreign wars, we see racist violence channeled into foreign wars in the book, and we see racist violence brought back home and fueled in the United States by the foreign wars. Do wars increase or decrease racism at home?
Well, they both, because that's the dialectical beauty of it, right? That the extremism and the trauma, not even more generalized non-racist trauma, but certainly much of the trauma of warfare is involved in the killing of culturally and racially other people, starting with Indian removal, going on through the Mexican-American War of the 1840s, going on through the wars of the final pacification of the West, the wars of the 1890s, and counterinsurgency in the Philippines. All of those were profoundly racist wars on the frontier, and that racism channeled back and blew back in all sorts of ways that we don't have time to talk about. But you, for instance, the Mexican-American War brought back a deep racism which infected what could have been a potentially radical free land that started off with a quite egalitarian vision but became increasingly racialized and racist as time went on. But that racism and trauma and extremism and brutality could be contained as well, could be basically rolled over into the next war. As long as you constantly had the next war coming up, teed up, then it didn't lead to a kind of breaking point or collapse domestically. Obviously, the Civil War was one major exception to this, and I discussed that in the book. But basically, yes, one war after another. John Quincy Adams called it recoil, right? The blowback from racist war on the frontier, how it would affect political culture and bind the nation together. Jumping ahead a century, Martin Luther King called war a demonic suction tube that prevented the creation of a more egalitarian culture and the transcendence of a myth of a rugged white individualism. And it worked. It worked up until about Vietnam, and when it started to all fall apart. And, the process is very complicated. But one way of thinking about it is usually episodes of white supremacist extremism happen when wars end. The second KKK was created after World War I, the white supremacist new right after Vietnam. What you begin to see around the catastrophe of post 9/11 foreign policy is even as the wars continue abroad, right? The United States is locked in this forever war in which Yemen is just one front or one battle. The domestic extremism starts to take hold simultaneously. The spread of border vigilantism begins around 2005, around the time of the Abu Ghraib scandal. There's many different markers to index the moral and tactical catastrophe of the invasion of Iraq, but certainly the Abu Ghraib scandal is one of them. And around 2005, 2006 is when you saw the spread of the militia movement, which I don't know, we probably don't have too much time to talk about it, but begin to take over public debate. Not only do they spread everywhere throughout the country, states that have no borders, they take over Fox News, they take over the Republican Party, and that's the backstory to Trump. A lot of it was in reaction to the failures in Iraq and Afghanistan. A lot of the militias that came back from those failed wars traveled to the border. Some of them were older generation of ex-Vietnam vets, but they're the ones that said, and they're the ones that, there was a split within the Republican Party between the George W. Bush wing that wanted some kind of immigration reform, that thought the best way to move forward for the Republican Party was to marginally expand the Latino vote. And then there was the wing that looked at what happened in California and thought that if that happened in Texas and Arizona, the Republican Party would cease to be a viable national party and went full on show me your papers. And that's the wing that basically has emerged and coalesced around Donald Trump.
I'm interested in this question because I've seen other studies that have found that racist violence escalates in the United States during and after wars. And as you've just been describing, we see anti-Muslim and racist violence brought home by recent wars. But the idea that's also prevalent in the book of the safety valve would suggest that someone might make the case the way to get rid of all this racist violence today in the United States is to channel it out into a good war on Iran or Venezuela or someplace.
But you can't. That's the point. There's no more. Barack Obama basically, he inherited the catastrophe and he stabilized the system and he restored the United States in pragmatic terms. But he had lost the ability to use foreign policy to channel the extremism outward, right? And you could see that with I think that's one of the things that's distinguished with Trump. There is yes, he has Venezuela and he talks about Iran and Cuba but there's no realm of foreign policy that domestic politicians have that they could use to organize domestic politics, to create a moral vision to point beyond the frontier. So that I think is what's different.
Because it's too discredited in everyone's eyes, or why?
Well, you're right. We have 800 military bases. We have, you know, we're continuing to run all of these many fronts in the forever war. But I think it's moral utility. The mission, you know, as Martin Luther King said, you know, the divine messianic mission of the United States that drove us into Vietnam is over. It's not, you know, I mean, even as Donald Trump runs these wars and expands them, as you said, he doesn't mobilize them in righteous or moral terms. It's just a kind of cruel, kind of petulant, we can bomb whoever we want and we're going to kill and whoever we want and no one is going to stop us. That's I think that's a definition of American freedom that has deep roots in American culture. Freedom is freedom from restraint. But for decades was whitewashed or presented as some kind of moral or higher universalism. Trump is that without without the gloss, and it's just this kind of petulant hedonism that says we could do whatever we want. We can drop more bombs and no one's going to tell it. We could kill as many civilians as we want. We could put kids in jail. We could separate families. We can drug them.
But are we out of danger of that, Greg Grandin? If President Pence or President Biden or President who knows who speaks far more morally and hides the torture better and so forth, are we out of?
So this is a question. This is a good question, and it's the question of methodology and the primacy of ideology versus material interests, and what is actually possible out in the world. It seems to me that the world has changed. It seems to me that that the U.S. still has the foundations of primacy in many ways. You know, the number one, still the number one currency, still control of energy markets, still in military bases. But it seems to me that the mission. It seems to me that the mission is over. For a long time, at least for two or three decades from Vietnam, politicians from both political parties were able to leverage the domestic polarization and use war and foreign policy to stifle the divisions, even as the war and foreign policy was worsening the division. It seems like we've crossed a threshold. It seems like Pence or Trump, or I can't imagine any Republican restoring the mission, and I think it's the same for Democrats too. I mean, I think the Democratic Party is obviously there's lots of specific issues: Israel, Venezuela. If you're in Florida, it's Venezuela and Cuba. If you're somewhere else, it's Israel. You know, but it seems to me that the ability to use foreign policy to create domestic hegemony is over, and we're entering a new stage. Now the question is whether there can be a political coalition that emerges from the ruins that could establish itself and establish legitimacy without the promise of endless growth, either in terms of markets or militarism, is an open question. I think, you know, maybe we're just in a permanent state of disequilibrium.
We've got just a few minutes left, and there's so many themes in this book, and I highly recommend people read the whole book. It's called The End of the Myth, From the Frontier to the Border Wall in the Mind of America. One of the themes I noticed was how much of this frontier and border violence is not governmental, but is going beyond the law. I mean, there were videos this week of vigilante groups down on the southern border of the United States rounding up, imprisoning people outside of government decree, and this was part of the history of the United States expansion across the continent. Is that always going to be with us?
Well, I mean, I think it'll be with us for quite a while. I think the border is a problem that has yet appeared. I mean, one of the arguments of the book is that the frontier is always at the same time the border, but it's after the Mexican-American War that this is a delinking. The border becomes established and the frontier continues to move forward. And what makes the U.S.-Mexican border different than other borders is that it's the principal axis in which North American capital is organized around, not just any other border. It has a foundational role in labor markets and capital markets and commodity markets short of going back to the way it was a century ago, where there was a free flow of people and seasonal migration, then I don't know if there's any way out. But certainly within the terms of domestic politics, I'm a little pessimistic.
What would be, other than the difficulty of getting there, what would be wrong with getting there to open borders?
Nothing. I mean, morally, I think that if you free commodities and free capital, I was just talking in political terms.
Sure.
If the whole point of NAFTA, and this is one of the things that why Trump's wall is important, not just as a symbol of Trump's racism and race realism, but it's a symbol of the hypocrisy of the establishment that he railed against and defeated, is that, you know, NAFTA was the grand crown jewel of economic integration, that high moment of globalization. And what did NAFTA do? NAFTA freed capital and it freed commodities, but it immobilized labor. NAFTA needs to be understood as going hand in hand with Clinton's militarization of the border. And that was the whole point. That Mexico's comparative advantage within the North American system was cheap labor, and you can't have cheap labor and mobile labor at the same time. So NAFTA was founded on the idea of militarizing the border, and that was the high point of that. So I think that we need to take seriously the hypocrisy of the previous order, not romanticize it, and imagine what a new arrangement would look like. And I think eventually moving towards open borders is both the moral and practical solution.
And the only one who pretended to be against NAFTA was, of course, Trump, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Well.
Yeah.
We have been speaking with Greg Grandin. His latest book, again, is The End of the Myth, From the Frontier to the Border Wall in the Mind of America. Highly recommend it. I listened to the audiobook. It was excellent, but take your choice of mediums. Greg Grandin is a professor at NYU and a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Greg Grandin, thank you very, very much for taking the time to come on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David. It was a wonderful conversation. It was a pleasure to be here.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, coverage of the resignation of Homeland Security Chief Kirstjen Nielsen showcased imperial court intrigue and how craven one can be and still be dubbed a grown-up in the room. Media interested in Nielsen's soft landing, will she get to make the seven-figure salary God intends for ex-officials? Will she have pleasant dining-out experiences? Might have spent more time on the victims of the policies she oversaw. Victims like Laura Maradiaga, an 11-year-old girl the government is trying to deport alone to El Salvador due to a backlogged court's clerical error. The immigration beat is multifaceted, for sure, and media choices about what to look at and who to listen to may be impactful as the White House looks set to make its war on immigrants a key piece of Trump's reelection drive. We'll talk about all of that with Tina Vasquez, senior immigration reporter at Rewire.news. Also on the show, the Trump administration is engaged in an open campaign of pressure on Iran that feels to many like a ramp up to war. U.S. sanctions have cost Iran some $10 billion, and now the White House seeks to cut off Iran's oil exports, a big part of its economy, entirely. Asked recently how he could guarantee that U.S. sanctions ostensibly aimed at the country's leaders would not harm the Iranian people, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo stated flatly, "There are no guarantees." Media coverage is less than helpful, shaped as it is by Iran's official enemy status, and even more by the implicit belief in the U.S.'s right to do whatever it wants. We'll talk about Iran policy with Sina Tusi, research associate at the National Iranian American Council. All of that's coming up, and we're going to get straight to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Babies pulled crying from their mother's arms. Asylum seekers detained under a highway overpass. Government officials tracking the menstrual cycles of teenaged migrants to better prevent them from accessing legal abortions. ICE swarming workplaces and loading people into vans. Reporting on immigration in Trump time presents a whack-a-mole of cruelty and crazy, and the job of prioritizing and presenting it for a limited attention span public already overloaded on outrage. With Trump planning to make immigration policy a prime emphasis in the next election, media's prism, media choices, may matter very much. What should we keep in mind as we see that reporting, and what might fall through the gaps? We're joined now by Tina Vasquez, the senior immigration reporter at Rewire.news. She joins us by phone from North Carolina. Welcome back to Counterspin, Tina Vasquez.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with Kirstjen Nielsen, just resigned as Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, a key executor of Trump immigration policies. You didn't start reporting on immigration with Nielsen or with Trump. So how would you place her tenure in the scheme of things in terms of impact?
What I think is really interesting is now under the Trump administration, you see journalists reaching out to people like Jay Johnson, who was DHS secretary under the Obama administration. And during Jay Johnson's time, Obama was deporting more people than any other time in his administration. They were quickly deporting asylum seekers that were newly arrived, that were from Central America, so a very similar situation to now. And now they're sort of deferring to him as an expert to comment on Trump's inhumane policies. So when Kirstjen Nielsen announced that she was resigning, that's kind of where my brain went. I worry about the ways that we forget and the ways that we normalize the things that DHS secretaries oversee. And under Nielsen, of course, there was the family separation policy that she lied to Congress about. That was actually in play much, much longer than we knew previously. It was almost a year where they were separating families. Some of it was a pilot program at certain areas along the border, but we still don't know how many families were subjected to that policy. And I worry about the way that she will become normalized and, you know, have a fellowship at a university or write a book or do speaking engagements. Like, I'm very curious to see how that's going to take shape for her.
I have to say, the way that you keep hold of a timeline and of the history is so critical, because you can only do that when you focus on impacts and on people rather than just looking at the folks at the top.
Sure.
Yeah, you have to keep your eyes on what's actually happening. Well, you reported earlier this month that under the Trump administration, there has been a shift in how ICE treats pregnant migrants in federal custody. And then in a different story, you reported about how Black undocumented women in Philadelphia face barriers to maternity care. So for one, it's kind of two questions. For one, there is a particular story in the impact of punitive immigration policies on women and on pregnant women, isn't there? And then the other thing that this underscores for me is that immigration isn't just a border story, and we have to remember that.
So I kind of write at the intersection of immigrant justice and reproductive justice, and there's a lot of reporting that needs to be done at that intersection, because so much of immigration reporting now is focused at what's happening to the border, what did Trump tweet, but there have been some very harmful policy changes under the Trump administration that have gotten some media attention, but in my opinion, not enough, and that's the treatment of pregnant people in custody. Whereas before, as part of ICE's normal processing, women who were 10, between the ages of 10 and 56 would be given a pregnancy test. And if that pregnancy test came back positive, they would be released from detention relatively quickly. And that is no longer the policy. So now we're detaining pregnant people, and there's been a lot of reporting about in-custody deaths and negligent medical care that people in detention receive. So now we are subjecting pregnant people to that kind of care. So what does prenatal care look like when you are subjected to indefinite detention? What does giving birth look like when you're subjected to indefinite detention? What happens to your child after you give birth when you have to return to the detention center? So those are the kind of questions that I'm now poking at and wondering now that this new policy is in place under the Trump administration.
Well, and you note that miscarriages appear to be on an increase, which might be natural to associate with this change in care.
I've been working on a piece since last year that is now finally in editing, but it's about other harmful practices that we're seeing under the Trump administration that we've seen with incarcerated women for a very long time. There's movement now to end shackling in prisons. We don't know if that translates to detention centers, but I've been in touch with a doctor in Texas who says that women who are pregnant and detained by ICE are shackled during childbirth, when accessing prenatal care, when accessing postpartum care. There's just a lot of alarming things that I'm learning about how this is taking shape.
Well, let me just ask you, what's it like trying to get information from an agency like ICE when you're asking, you know, how are you treating pregnant women in federal care, for example, in federal custody? What's it like trying to extract information from the agency?
It's impossible. Huh. It is very clear that you're given sort of a template boilerplate response. If I have very particular questions I'm asking about a very particular person's case or something that a doctor told me at a very particular facility, it's just cut and pasted. You know, this is the number of pregnant people that we had in detention in August 2018. Here are a link to our standards of care. And that's kind of the end of it. And so you are forced to find other ways to gather information, to piece things together. Of course, people who tell me what happened to them, I always believe them. And they're the experts on what's happening in detention centers. But as a journalist, you have to reach out to ICE and you have to give them the opportunity to respond and hopefully provide information. And that just doesn't happen.
Well, that's actually something I kind of wanted to follow up with. My litany at the beginning might also have included the state trying to hold unaccompanied migrant children at toxic waste sites, you know, which is another thing that you've reported earlier this year. And you write about policy and people. And I just wonder, how do you determine where the individual narrative is crucial or most useful, and when statistics or political history or some kind of bigger picture might be necessary? Or is that just journalism?
I'm sure it's different for different people. The way that I approach it first is with people. And so a person tells me this is what happened to me, and then I start poking at the context for that. When do we know that this started happening? Under what administration has this happened? How did this policy that made this happen take shape? So people first, then providing context for people to better understand what is happening to that person. That's kind of the formula I use for reporting.
Well, and some of your reporting reflects community solidarity and community resistance. And that's very much part of the story of this immigration situation that we're in. And particularly, you know, when you write from North Carolina about community response to ICE workplace raids, for example, you know, there's a whole story in what happens to communities once people are removed or that are being targeted for raids. And that community story, I think, maybe is not always told.
I know that that's something that I would like to get better at. That's something that I would like to see immigration reporting at large get better at. Under this administration in particular, it can feel very hard. I used to say there's no time for happy stories, right? You're being pummeled by all of this bad news. It doesn't make sense to write a happy story. But what I'm coming to understand about my own reporting is there are ways to highlight and showcase the resilience of communities and the way that they're fighting back. So when I wrote a story about a Black undocumented woman and what it was like for her to access prenatal care, that sounds like a hard, sad story, but it wasn't. She, despite having very few resources, figured it out and went from Philadelphia to New York City on a train several times a month to access care in a state that had friendlier benefits to undocumented immigrants. There's a Black woman I interview in the piece who has decided to become a doula in order to fight back against the crisis that Black pregnant women are experiencing when it comes to maternal health. So there are ways to uplift the resilience of communities and ways they're fighting back without hitting people over the head with it. And you know, just being very intentional about how to include that in your reporting, I think, is becoming more and more important.
Well, there's much more we could talk about, but I'd like to end on that note. We've been speaking with Tina Vasquez. She's senior immigration reporter at Rewire.news. Thank you so much, Tina Vasquez, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
An April 22nd New York Times story began, quote, "The Trump administration is poised to end a program that has allowed five large nations, including China and India, to buy Iranian oil, despite American sanctions," two senior American officials said on Sunday, a decision that is intended to squeeze Tehran's government, but could lead to higher oil and gasoline prices. Close quote. The story stated clearly that, quote, "the move to choke off all exports of Iranian oil is part of an increasingly aggressive pressure campaign by the Trump administration to starve Iran of revenue with the goals of forcing political change among its ruling clerics and getting it to rein in its military actions across the Middle East." And it continued, "But the decision also risks increasing frictions with other nations, including some major American allies, and hindering other policy priorities," close quote. The next day's Times continued the theme with a piece beginning, quote, "In tightening sanctions on Iran, the Trump administration moved on Monday to isolate Tehran economically and undercut its power across the Middle East. But the clampdown has complicated relations with China at a particularly sensitive moment," close quote. You get the idea. The Trump administration's maximum pressure campaign against Iran, aimed nakedly at strangling the country's economy in order to force it to change its government to one compliant with U.S. demands, is not itself problematic, but it might have some negative ancillary impacts. It's hard to maintain such a frame if you consider the lives of ordinary Iranians, which these articles do not. Here to shed a different light on the state of U.S. policy toward Iran is Sina Tusi, research associate at the National Iranian American Council. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Sina Tusi.
Hey, thanks for having me on. It's good to be here.
Last November, the U.S. demanded that everyone in the world stop importing Iranian oil or else face sanctions from the United States. Waivers were granted to a handful of countries, including Iran's biggest customers, China and India. And now on May 2nd, those waivers are going to be ended. This is just part of this strategy of sanctions that's called maximum pressure. What should we know, first of all, about the impact of this White House campaign, including the likely impact of this latest move, on regular Iranian people?
The so-called maximum pressure campaign that the Trump administration is pursuing against Iran is very unprecedented in scope. This aim to reduce Iranian oil exports to zero and now terminating these oil waivers for these five countries that were still importing Iranian oil, this is something the U.S. has never tried to attempt before. It does amount to a full-on oil embargo of Iran's oil exports. And Iran, you know, oil is the lifeblood of its economy. It accounts for something around 30 to 40% of its government budget. And right now we're seeing, you know, coupled with the Trump administration's broader sanctions on Iran, these kind of nuclear sanctions that they reimposed after the Trump administration withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal last year, you know, all foreign investment has left the country. Iran's kind of trade with much of the world has been cut off. And this has really debilitated the Iranian economy, and first and foremost, it's ordinary Iranians who are paying the price. These sanctions are amounting to collective punishment against the entire Iranian population. Right now, we're seeing that the Iranian middle class is becoming impoverished. Space for Iranian civil society is diminishing. The cost of everyday goods is going up. The cost of living is increasing. There's been inflation. The currency has devalued. So right now, it's causing immense economic hardship in Iran. And you know, right now we see that the Trump administration and Secretary of State Pompeo, they often frame their rhetoric towards Iran about helping the Iranian people. And they have this idea that they promote that these policies help the Iranian people or they support the Iranian people against their authoritarian government, when in reality, it's crippling the space needed for peaceful democratic change in Iran. You know, by impoverishing the middle class, which is the vehicle for economic and political development, it's only creating a destructive situation inside the country.
Well, and then what should we know about the impact of these sanctions on the various factions of government within Iran?
Right now, we see that these factions and entities like the Revolutionary Guards, they are well-connected and they have the means to evade sanctions. And the track record of sanctions, U.S. sanctions policy in other countries always shows that these authoritarian countries, the ruling elites themselves suffer the least from sanctions.
Mm-hmm.
And they manage to consolidate resources around them, and it's the ordinary people who are hurt. And right now in Iran, we are seeing that the Trump administration's Iran policy is overall empowering the most hardline factions in Iran, the kind of most reactionary elements that oppose the nuclear negotiations that led to the nuclear deal, that oppose these kind of more moderate reformist rivals that they have within the country, represented by President Rouhani and Foreign Minister Zarif, and they were always opposed to the nuclear negotiations. These forces have been empowered, and these sanctions, the Revolutionary Guard is capable of evading these sanctions, and it's only going to increase its tentacles all around the Iranian economy and increase its influence throughout the country. And, you know, other kind of economic actors within the country are going to be ever more dependent on the Revolutionary Guard. So it's really entrenching them as opposed to a policy that would have engaged Iran economically, kind of what we had after the nuclear deal with Obama, that Iran was integrating with the world economically, and Iran's private sector was booming. There was kind of unemployment was decreasing, and the Revolutionary Guards and these hardliners were very upset with that situation after the nuclear deal.
Well, it's hard to think how Trump and Pompeo and National Security Advisor John Bolton, another architect of this maximum pressure policy, how they think Iran will respond to this bend the knee demand. You know, in a press meeting that Axios reported, Pompeo said that the administration is careful not to use the language of regime change and insisted that the U.S. has no plans to intervene militarily in Iran. But all of this, along with the Revolutionary Guard being designated a foreign terrorist organization, another unprecedented move, all of this seems like an amp up to war, doesn't it?
Yes, and I would just add that the administration's Iran policy is really being driven by John Bolton and the National Security Council, not as much even Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who himself is an ardent Iran hawk. But we see that even in this issue of the oil waivers, according to reporting, the State Department was actually hesitant and opposed to terminating these oil waivers, but Bolton pushed for it, and Bolton ultimately won that debate within the administration. And, you know, Bolton is someone who has a track record of, you know, supporting military strikes against Iran. And right now, this administration's policy is really to bait Iran to leave the nuclear deal and then have this kind of escalation cycle ensue. Like, their idea is that, you know, then the Europeans would come on board with additional sanctions on Iran. And for Bolton and them, if they get Iran to leave the nuclear deal, they would have a pretext to potentially launch military strikes or, you know, escalate even more. So this dangerous escalation cycle will ensue if Iran does leave the nuclear deal. And right now, Iran has very, very little benefits from staying in the nuclear deal. Obviously, with all these sanctions and the nuclear sanctions that got reimposed, Iran lost all the economic benefits that the deal gave it. And these additional sanctions, these oil waivers being terminated, designating the Revolutionary Guards as a terrorist organization, these are, in some cases, redundant sanctions that foreclose the potential for future diplomacy, and they're additional sanctions that are harming Iran in other ways. So, and this all incentivizes Iran to pursue a tit-for-tat strategy and to escalate, and it's a very dangerous situation. And, you know, people like John Bolton, National Security Council, every piece of evidence suggests that they want more escalation.
There are historical echoes, of course, as well, and the U.S.-backed British blockade was what went right before the 1953 coup, you know, and Iran hasn't, U.S. media don't talk about that much, but Iran hasn't forgotten it.
Right, and that's the closest historical parallel to the Trump administration's Iran policy right now is the 1953 U.K.-U.S. coup that overthrew the democratically elected prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh. And during that time, you know, Mossadegh had nationalized the Iranian oil industry, and the British kind of blockaded Iran's oil exports, and the U.S. supported that. So right now we're seeing a similar policy being pursued. There's oil blockade. There's a regime change agenda. So it's very analogous.
And yet, I mean, there's some sense, and you've pointed to it, even within the U.S. government and certainly overseas, that not everybody is on board with this. Not everyone thinks this is smart or effective or safe, even labeling the Revolutionary Guard a terrorist organization. There's a lot of potential danger that lots of folks actually see. They're just kind of being talked over. Is that it?
Absolutely. I mean, the administration is very isolated in its Iran policy in the world stage. Obviously, the rest of the powers that negotiated the Iran nuclear deal, which is the European Union, Germany, France, the UK, Russia, and China as well, they're all still in the deal. They support preserving the deal. Iran is obviously still in the deal. Iranian compliance with the nuclear agreement has been confirmed in every report by the International Atomic Energy Agency since the report was implemented in 2016, the U.S. intelligence community also confirms Iran's continued adherence to the nuclear deal. And the Europeans, other powers, are all finding ways to try to sidestep these U.S. sanctions and preserve the nuclear deal and kind of wait out the Trump administration. So we've seen the Europeans, it's very unprecedented, this kind of fissure that has emerged over Iran policy, among all the other factors that have increased the transatlantic divide under Trump. The Europeans have devised right now this financial mechanism to facilitate humanitarian trade with Iran, and the idea is that eventually would facilitate Iranian oil imports. And this mechanism would circumvent the U.S. financial system, kind of other banks that would be vulnerable to American sanctions. So it's really overall this Iran policy is also diminishing U.S. economic and financial power by encouraging countries to find ways to sidestep sanctions and develop these new institutions and mechanisms.
Well, let me finally read you this quote from the Washington Post. They say that Pompeo estimated that U.S. sanctions have cost Iran $10 billion so far. Quote, the regime would have used that money to support terror groups like Hamas and Hezbollah and continue with its missile development in defiance of U.N. Security Council Resolution 2231, Pompeo told reporters, and it would have perpetuated a humanitarian crisis in Yemen. Close quote. And the story doesn't bat an eye. It gives readers no indication of any hypocrisy contained in those claims. And I've said many times that acceptance of U.S. exceptionalism and the rights of empire are kind of the price of admission to elite media's foreign policy conversation. But it makes things like this campaign on Iran very hard to understand, I think, even if a story is factually accurate. What would you like to see from news media going forward in terms of covering Iran and U.S.-Iran relations?
I mean, the coverage overall, unfortunately, has been biased for years and continues to be grossly biased. And this kind of only encourages bad policies. You know, when we have a false understanding of these countries, these events, you know, when there's these certain narratives that are inaccurate and they're really ultimately in the service of these kind of hawkish, aggressive policies that are self-defeating ultimately for the U.S. It gets us in these wars and quagmires abroad. And right now we see with the administration's Iran policy and something like this quote by Brian Hook that you just read, the administration's Iran policy, despite all these sanctions, it has not changed Iran's regional policy. So it's been a failure in that regard. They say the goal is these 12 demands they have of Iran, changing regional policy, changing certain stuff. It's failed to meet all of those demands. You know, we need to have a nuanced discussion about why Iran has these national security policies in the region. Who are these different groups? Are they just reflexively Iranian proxies? Iran pulls their strings, whether that be Houthis or groups in Lebanon or Iraq, or are these groups, do they have their own supporters and constituencies within these countries that might be independent of Iran, or even if the Islamic Republic, the government of Iran, were to collapse tomorrow, would these groups suddenly disappear or not? There's a gap regarding this kind of more nuanced explanation that we need of the Middle East that would help us get better policies. But unfortunately, that's lacking.
We've been speaking with Sina Tusi, research associate at the National Iranian American Council. They're online at niacouncil.org. Sina Tusi, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on FAIR's website, fair.org. The website's also the place to sign up for FAIR's Newsletter Extra, our Action Alert Network, or to subscribe to Counterspin as a podcast. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
So we tell you calmly and very sincerely, if you frighten easily, turn off your radio now.
On September 20th, 2017, record-smashing Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico. Thousands died because of it. New science confirms the devastating rains and floods during Maria were far more likely due to climate change. According to recent data from the U.S. Census Bureau, after the storm, about 4% of the population of the island fled for the United States mainland. They are among the new American climate refugees, joining those from Hurricanes Harvey and Katrina. The new paper is titled Extreme Rainfall Associated with Hurricane Maria Over Puerto Rico and Its Connections to Climate Variability and Change. We have reached the lead author, Dr. David J. Keelings, Assistant Professor in the Department of Geography at the University of Alabama. From Tuscaloosa, David Keelings, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Just 8 days before Maria struck, you and your co-author, Jose Hernandez Ayala, published research on extreme floods and tropical cyclones in Puerto Rico. What got you studying that even before the big disaster struck?
My co-author is actually from Puerto Rico. He grew up there, and so he still has family there, and his wife's family are from there. So he's very much still in touch with people on the island, and we both have an interest in extreme events, and particularly precipitation, especially out of hurricanes. So we got together. We both actually overlapped for a while in graduate school, so we knew each other, and decided to look into what was going on in Puerto Rico. It's a very interesting place climatologically because it's a very small island, but it has a very disproportionate amount of very high flows, high river flows. Most of the really extreme flows that are recorded for the entire United States are coming from Puerto Rico and Hawaii, two tropical islands that get huge amounts of hydrologic variability in their response to rainfall. So it's an interesting place to look at.
Would you say the people of that island were relatively adapted to heavy rainfall before Hurricane Maria struck?
I suspect so. I've never visited, but historically they're no stranger to very extreme variability in rainfall and in flooding events. Most of their basins, their rivers can go orders of magnitude in, variability in terms of their flow almost overnight. They're very used to huge changes in their hydrology.
David, what made the rains of Maria so exceptional?
Well, that's what the paper was looking at. The first thing that we did was we basically had three questions that we wanted to answer. The first one was, how unusual was Maria in the climatology and the history of the island going back to the beginning of the record that we had, 1956, which is when we kind of have reliable data back to. And so we wanted to know, was it really unusual? We found out that it was. It's a lot heavier precipitation than any other hurricane event that's impacted the island in the last, 60-some years. And not just that it's the highest, but also it's significantly higher than anything that's happened before, 30 to 60%, depending on what metric you're looking at, but 30 to 60% higher than previous storms like Hurricane George's in 98 and Tropical Storm Isabel, too. It's so much higher than these other events. And then the second thing that we wanted to ask was, is something like Maria's magnitude of precipitation, is that becoming more likely through the record? And what we found was it is becoming much more likely from the 1950s to today's climate. It's become about three times more likely to happen in the climate of today versus at the beginning of the record. And then finally, we wanted to, and this comes back to your question, we wanted to get at this question of what is causing this change and what can we attribute this increased likelihood of this kind of event in Puerto Rico to? Is it part of natural cycles of variability, or is it part of a longer-term trend, i.e. climate change? And so we went about that using a fairly complex statistical methodology where we essentially look at the climate at the beginning of the record, we look at the climate of 2017 when Maria happened, and we estimate probability of Maria in these two settings. But we then construct a what we call counterfactual reality. We construct a world that never was, a world that has all of the natural variability that was present in 2017 when Maria happened, but the one thing that we change that makes it not reality anymore is we dial back climate change to what it was in the 1950s. So things like global atmospheric temperature, we dial that back to 1950s. We dial back the amount of moisture in the atmosphere. We dial back the sea surface temperatures. We dial back the CO2 in the atmosphere. And then we re-estimate the probability of something like Maria's rainfall happening. And then we can compare those probabilities to each other. And when we do that, so we're isolating the impact of human-induced climate change by doing this, we find that Maria's rainfall is actually five times more likely in the climate of today under climate change, under the human influence on the climate, versus what it was in the 1950s without as much human-induced climate change. So, you know, to say that a hurricane like Maria is caused by something is very difficult to do, and you should be very, very careful of that. What we are able to do with attribution science these days, and attribution science is a relatively new field, but what we are able to do is estimate changing likelihood, changing probability or risk of events happening. And what we're able to say with something like Maria is it is X times more likely because of long-term trends associated with climate change. And again, what we found is it's now about five times more likely.
So does that mean that Puerto Rico and the Caribbean should experience more big storms like that sooner than we would have otherwise thought?
Well, again, we can't really say that climate change is causing hurricanes. Hurricanes are chaotic events. They're random events. They're extreme events. And they're happening in a chaotic global atmosphere. So in any year, there's the chance that you will have hurricanes happening. But again, they're random events, and there's many natural processes that cause fewer or more hurricanes in any given year. What we're saying is that when a hurricane does form, when those random chaotic conditions are just right and a hurricane gets going, in a warming climate, that hurricane is more likely to intensify. It's more likely to become higher category hurricane, and it's more likely to do that at a faster pace. It's more likely to go from a category 1 to 2, 3, 4, all the way up to 5 much more quickly. So it's more likely to spend a longer part of its lifespan at a higher category and be more intense. And when it moves over land, it's likely to drop more rainfall when it's moving over the land. There's also a lot of research out there that's saying now that hurricanes under climate change are moving slower. They have what's called slower translational speed. So if you imagine a hurricane coming over the top of you and it's dropping all of that rain, it's really bad if it's moving slower, because then it spends longer over the top of you and it drops more rainfall at your particular location. So under climate change, all of these things are likely to change in hurricanes. They're likely to be more intense, intensify more rapidly, spend longer part of their lifespan at higher intensity, and also to drop more precipitation. These are all things that have been theoretically known for decades now. If you asked an atmospheric scientist or a climate scientist 40 years ago, what would happen if we warmed up the planet? What would happen if the air temperature increased? What would happen if the sea surface increased? What would happen if, because of that, the atmosphere can hold more moisture? And you said to them, what's going to happen if a hurricane forms in that kind of climate? They would tell you, oh, it's going to intensify faster, it's probably going to spend longer at a higher category, and it's also going to drop more rainfall. These are things that are no surprise based on our scientific physical understanding of what hurricanes do. But now with attribution science, we can actually say, okay, these things that we have always known are likely to happen, we can now say that they are happening, and we can attribute it to something like climate change. So that's what's particularly exciting in the field at the moment. Going back to your question about the Caribbean, you know, we can't say that more hurricanes are necessarily going to happen, but we can say that when one does happen, if it interacts with an island in the Caribbean, it's probably going to be a higher intensity hurricane than it would have been otherwise, and it's definitely going to drop more rainfall than it would have done otherwise.
Science warns we should expect about 7% more water vapor in the air for every 1 degree of ocean warming. Now, a new report from the World Meteorological Organization says in 2018, the heat content of the upper levels of the ocean were the highest ever recorded. I'm wondering, maybe will we see a new scale of hurricane rains, maybe off the scale? Do you think we'll need a Category 6 designation for the coming storms?
Yeah, you know, possibly some researchers have hinted at that that's a possibility, that, again, hurricanes are likely to intensify faster and they're likely to spend longer at those higher categories. You know, I think that there is a physical upper limit. There's a bound there. You can't go too much off the scale in terms of hurricanes. There is a thermodynamic limit that they will reach. But I think it is highly likely, yes, that hurricanes, again, when the conditions are right and one does happen, it's likely that it's going to spend longer as an intense hurricane, a Category 4, a Category 5, and perhaps even wind speeds that are edging to the, you know, upper limits of Category 5, it's likely to spend longer with those kinds of conditions, and it's certainly likely to drop more precipitation because there's, just as you said, every 1 degree Celsius that we warm up, there's more moisture in the atmosphere. The hurricane is working with that more moisture, and it's able to convert that into rainfall.
Just out of curiosity, is there a name or a definite level for that thermodynamic limit to the power of hurricanes?
You know, that's not really something I study. Wouldn't like to hazard a guess on that, but I'm sure that from what I read, that yes, there is a limit that hurricanes can reach. Yes.
All right. You in your paper also talk about other factors that can beef up wind speeds and the amount of water carried in hurricanes in the mid-Atlantic region. You talk about the El Niño-La Niña balance or the Atlantic multi-decadal oscillation. Were those factors in Maria, as far as you know?
Well, yes. So what we did was to look at our attribution statement again. We're looking at the climate as it was in 2017 with all of these natural influences, and then we're comparing that to the climate sort of counterfactual reality of 2017, but dialing back the longer-term trends that are associated with climate change. So as we do that, we keep North Atlantic Oscillation, Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation, El Niño, we keep all of those things in there. And so we didn't look at those natural factors directly, other than when you look at the paper, we do say that in observational record, the probability of something of Maria's magnitude of precipitation has gone, at the beginning of the record in the 1950s, has gone from about a 300-year return event down to about 100-year return event in the climate of today. And so as you know, but I'll go over this briefly, as you know, a return period is an estimate of probability. So people have often heard of the 500-year flood or the 100-year flood. This is a statement of probability. It does not mean that a 100-year flood happens this year and it will not happen again for 100 years. There's a probability of it happening in every single year. A 100-year flood just means that in any given year, there's a 1% chance of it happening. And so we went from a 300-year event, so that's a chance in any given year of about 0.3%, to down to a 1 in 100 year return period event. So that's a 1% chance. So that's about a 3 times increase in the probability of Maria happening when we just look at the observational record. Now, when we did our attribution study as part of this, what we found was about a 5 times increase in the likelihood of Maria's precipitation when we isolate the effects of climate change alone. So there's a discrepancy there between the 3 times increase in likelihood that we found from the observational record versus the 5 times increase that we found when we attribute that change to climate change alone. So that suggests to us that that discrepancy between the 5 times and the 3 times increase in likelihood has to do with natural factors like ENSO, like NEO, like AMO, actually counteracting the effect of climate change to some extent. So we can probably say with some certainty that natural factors should actually reduce the effect of climate change in the instance of Maria as it was in 2017. So in other words, if only climate change was acting on increasing the likelihood of Maria, Maria should be 5 times more likely, but it's only 3 times more likely. So that means that El Nino and NEO and AMO actually reduced that likelihood a little bit. So they are actually favorable for reducing the intensity of Maria in 2017.
Thank you for explaining that. I had not heard that before. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. David Keeling from the University of Alabama. We're talking about extreme rains from the new breed of climate-enhanced hurricanes, or at least the probability of that happening. Now, David, closer to your home state of Alabama, or now it's your home state, I guess, a report released in April by NOAA and the National Weather Service upgrades Hurricane Michael to Category 5, and that joins only 3 Cat 5 hurricanes to make landfall in the continental United States. Michael smashed Florida in the panhandle on October 7, 2018. Did you feel the effects of that storm in Alabama?
Yeah, we did. We did to some extent. I'm in Tuscaloosa, which is more kind of in northern Alabama. We're about 4 hours away from the Gulf of Mexico if you were to drive it. So we didn't feel a huge impact up here, but certainly in southern Alabama, they did, and round about, as you said, the panhandle in Florida. By the time it was further north, we got some wind and we got some rain, but it was not a severe impact like they had in the panhandle.
There's a bunch of new studies out on Hurricane Harvey and the increased risks of extreme rains hitting the U.S. Gulf Coast. And one study found, and I'll quote Dr. Jeff Masters here, climate change made Hurricane Florence's most intense rains over North Carolina in 2018 more than 50% greater in magnitude than they would have been otherwise. David, what do you make of this burst of new science and the pattern coming out of it as warming develops?
Well, I think it's all very interesting. I think that most of these studies, including my own, I mean, they've been conducted by independent researchers, and in many ways we use varied techniques and varied data sets to look at these things. And I think it's interesting that all of these studies are independently finding very similar results. We're all finding that the rainfall being produced by these high category storms is increasing significantly. And also we're all finding that we can attribute that increase in rainfall intensity to climate change. And so this is very, very interesting. It's something, again, that theoretically we've known for several decades, but now we're actually able to say, okay, we're seeing this happening, and we can actually say with some certainty that climate change is playing a role in the increased precipitation that we're seeing.
A few years ago, you did some interesting research into increasing heat waves expected in Florida as climate change develops. What should people there expect?
So, yeah, we looked at the likelihood of heat waves. Heat waves are very difficult to define. There are many different definitions of what constitutes a heat wave. There's just about as many definitions of a heat wave as there are studies on heat waves. But we looked at extremely high daily maximum temperatures, also co-occurring with very high nighttime minimum temperatures, because if you look at the public health and epidemiology literature, health professionals are concerned about not just it being really hot during the daytime hours, but also it remaining hot over nighttime hours so people don't get a sort of chance to recuperate during the nighttime when normally it would cool down. If it stays hot at night, it's bad news, as well as it being hot during the daytime. So we looked at what's called a bivariate approach to heat waves, where we looked at the maximum and the minimum. And what we found is that in the last or most recent 25 years of temperature records in Florida, we see this increasing likelihood of heat waves, not just in terms of the frequency or the number of events that have occurred, but also we're seeing changes in the duration of those events, so how long a heat wave will last for. Obviously, the longer a heat wave goes on, the more chance that more people are going to be impacted by it. And also, we found that the magnitude of the events are increasing generally when heat waves are happening. In the most recent 25-year period, we're seeing that they're more intense heat waves. And then also we found, interestingly, that the timing of events is changing through the year. Heat waves are happening earlier and earlier in the summertime. And that's particularly concerning because heat waves and their impact on people has a lot to do with people's acclimatization to heat. When a heat wave happens later on in the summertime, people are already acclimatized to those warmer temperatures. They're used to it. They're already in summer. They know it's hot out and their bodies are more adjusted to it. So when heat waves are changing their timing in the year and happening earlier, it's going to catch people out when people are not acclimatized to those really high temperatures. So suddenly you hit people in the springtime with a really bad heat wave, then it's going to impact more people.
And it also has a big effect on agriculture. I've lived in Florida before, and I know that all of that timing really matters to the people who are producing a lot of the nation's agricultural products.
Oh, absolutely, yes. I mean, heat waves put a huge stress on crops. And, you know, particularly in the summertime in places like Florida, it's already hot. If you have a heat wave, typically heat waves are also accompanied by clear skies, lack of rainfall. And so you're really stressing the crops with a really intense temperatures that wilts the crops, but also a lack of rainfall. So they don't get any evaporative cooling, and they also, you know, they don't get any replenishing of their soil moisture. So it's particularly stressful for plants.
David, what are you working on next? And in your field of interest, what critical science do you think could tell us more?
Well, I'm currently working on a project to look at heat waves across the continental United States. We're kind of taking a somewhat novel approach, in that we're looking at heat waves much more spatially. We're thinking about them more as geometric shapes or blobs, if you will, on the landscape. Because we already know fairly well in the literature, this has been observed for a long time now, and we're very certain of this in the science, is that heat waves generally globally are becoming much more frequent, much higher in their magnitude, much more intense, and longer duration. This is something that, you know, for example, the IPCC talks about in the reports, that we're very, very certain that heat waves are increasing in these ways and likely to continue to increase in magnitude, intensity, and frequency as we move forward under a change in climate. And so what we're trying to do is actually look at heat waves and think about their size. So we know that heat waves, like I said, are becoming more frequent and higher in their magnitude, but we've not really known when a heat wave happens, is it becoming bigger? Is it larger? Is it affecting more people over a larger area when it occurs? And has that got anything to do with climate change? Is it some sort of manifestation of a warming climate on the land surface to affect the size and shape of heat waves? So that's kind of what I'm working on right now, to look at, okay, we know more are going to happen, but are they going to be bigger in terms of the aerial extent? So yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of interesting work going on in the scientific community at the moment in terms of climate science. I think that the attribution work that I've been involved with to some extent, and what so many other independent groups are working on, is highly exciting. This ability to now answer sort of what the public may be wondering about. You know, the public thinks about climate change and always after a storm or a heat wave, there's always questions of, was this caused by human-induced climate change? And we still can't say if any one particular event is caused by climate change. Was it a physical mechanism that caused it? We can't say that, but what we can say is how much more likely these sorts of events are now than what they used to be. And we can also say how that likelihood is likely to change moving forward. And I think that this is something that's very powerful. It's very useful for people to know. And I think it should be something that influences policymakers, hopefully.
We have been talking with scientist David Keelings from the University of Alabama, and you can find links to this paper about climate change and the deadly rains of Hurricane Maria and all the hurricane news we've been discussing in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. David, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
You're very welcome.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
When the Arctic sea ice crashed in 2007, it was a great signal of human interference in the climate of this planet. Now, Swiss researchers have found another. Beginning in 2010, giant heat waves appeared in multiple places around the Earth at the same time. Dr. Marco Fokel is a postdoctoral researcher of land climate dynamics at ETH Zurich, the Swiss Federal Institute of Science and Technology. She is co-author of a paper still awaiting publication but already causing waves. Although based in Zurich, we reached Marta in Budapest. Marco Fokel, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, good afternoon.
Tell us about the massive heat experienced in many places around the Northern Hemisphere in 2018, please.
We were investigating the areas which were concurrently affected by hot extremes in 2018 in the Northern Hemisphere. Multiple regions in the Northern Hemisphere experienced heat-related impacts at the same time. What we were doing then was to consider hot days in key agriculture and densely populated regions in the Northern Hemisphere, because these are the regions which can be strongly exposed to extreme heat. We computed the areas which were concurrently affected by hot days in 2018. We found that there was a large area. And if we're considering the area that was affected between May and July in 2018, we found that it was on average 22% of the Northern Hemispheric region, which is densely populated or key agricultural regions. If you are looking at these 22% from 2018, which were on average affected every day between May and July, it makes a new record. So if you're considering these areas from 1958 to 2018, there was a strong increase in the recent decade. And also in 2010, we had a large area that was affected by concurrent extreme heat. But 2018 makes a new record if you're considering the area between May and July.
So during these times, I mean, we had things like rails melting and there were heat deaths and some crop failures. So there are a lot of ramifications to what you're describing.
Yes, that's why we think it's really necessary to look at the areas which are actually affected, because if you have key agricultural regions and densely populated areas, this can have strong implications. We collected media articles and we found that in at least 17 countries across the Northern Hemisphere, multiple impacts were reported. We found these damages to infrastructure, but also crop failure in Central Europe, in the United Kingdom, and then also in other regions. And even lots of people were directly affected by extreme heat, and heat deaths were reported in Japan and South Korea also.
It's interesting because each of us experiences the heat. We had a very hot year here in British Columbia, and we had a lot of wildfires. But we don't put it together as a world picture, and I wonder who is responsible for tracking heat and finding what you found.
This is really the main message from our study, that we have this strong impact which occurred in many regions at the same time, and this can then have strong implications. You mentioned fires in British Columbia, and also there were lots of wildfires in Scandinavia. If we experience such events more often in the future, and one country already has large areas which are affected by fires, and another country also calls for emergency, and there can be limited infrastructure to actually fight the fires. And therefore, we considered a multi-model ensemble from state-of-the-art model simulation and computed probabilities of such large areas to have occurred in a case with climate change and in a case without climate change. And here we focus on a historical period where we experience the climate change signal to be small. And when we are doing so, we actually find that in this historical period where we think that the climate change signal was small, that such large areas like 2018 never occur. So this leads to the conclusion that actually human-induced climate change was necessary for such an event to occur. So a 2018-like heatwave area could not have occurred without human-induced climate change.
It's interesting, though, that some of your earlier research that you co-authored brings up a question, because you looked into the year 1540 and what appeared to be a very hot time then. And now, 500 years later, we have another series of heat waves. And as soon as I looked at news of your research, because it hasn't been published yet, is that correct? Not published yet?
Yeah, that's still under review, yeah. It's minor revision, so it's in the process.
As soon as I heard about it, I thought about the 2010 heat wave where Russia, one of the world's largest wheat exporters, suffered so much crop loss that they canceled grain exports. And I was thinking, well, what if North America also lost wheat to heat at the same time? There could have been a food crisis, possibly even famine. Does your new research suggest perhaps we're entering an age where multiple food failures could occur?
Actually, our results can point into this direction, because we investigated also climate model projections for the future, and we found that in a case where we have 2 degrees global warming, such an area like 2018 could occur on average nearly every year. So if you imagine that the 2018-like area would occur on average every year, this can have strong implications, for example, on food security. So if you have multiple breadbaskets where we have crop failure at the same time, then this can also have strong implications on trade, and trade cannot face these crop failure, because when they occur in multiple regions at the same time, and this can then have actually strong implications on food security. And also, if you consider like many areas concurrently affected by wildfires, then we can also get a problem with infrastructure to actually fight the fires. Our results show that under 1 degree warming, such an area like 2018 could occur 1 out of 6 years. So even today, it's not unlikely, but it was still an unprecedented event. If we go in future for 1.5 degree global warming, then we find that every 2 out of 3 years such an event could occur. And if you go then even to 2 degree global warming, for such an event could occur nearly every year on average. So that means we could such a year like 2018 could occur nearly every year. And then also it would be more difficult to compensate last year's failure if the next year, again, the large area will be under extreme heat. So this can have really strong implications, because if you have a year like 1 out of 6 years, then the other years you might compensate the losses from 1 year. But if such an event would occur nearly every year on average, then we can expect strong impacts.
So we would possibly have no time to recover from the damages the year previous. Marta Fogel, based on earlier science you co-authored, is it possible heat events are also due or affected by large-scale land use changes in Europe and across the mid-latitudes?
Heat waves can have multiple causes, and we find that there's like smoking situation is necessary to large heat waves to occur, but then also processes on land really can amplify the development of heat waves. So what we were focusing on our research group is really the climate dynamics or land atmosphere feedback. And also if you have land use change and then we change, for example, from forest to grass, so moisture and latent heat flux, and therefore can also influence the development of heat waves.
Canadian government scientists just released a report saying Canada is warming at twice the global average. In earlier work, your group says Central Europe is also expected to warm more strongly than the world average. First of all, for our international audience, what is meant by Central Europe? And second, why would that region warm more than many other places?
Actually, when we are talking about global warming or global mean temperature, whole world and all areas on land, we have a stronger increase in temperature than over the global, because the globe is suffered with the strong regions, which are the ocean, and this, the ocean cools less strong than the land. So when we are looking on land regions, we always find a stronger warming signal than over most areas on land. We find stronger warming than global mean temperature, because land warms faster than the ocean.
It's interesting because people picture Switzerland as a cooler, mountainous place, but Switzerland was also struck by excessive heat last year?
Yes, hot temperatures. And what was also the case for Switzerland was that it was a really dry year last year. And if you have a dry year, and which is accompanied by also like a hot and dry year, then there can be feedback processes that accelerate the warming. And of course also, for example, crop harvest.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. My guest is Dr. Marta Fokel from ETH Zurich. We are discussing brand new science about the massive heat waves appearing across the Northern Hemisphere in recent years. Marta, do you have any indication that this is purely a Northern Hemisphere phenomenon? Could it also happen in the Southern Hemisphere, or is there too much ocean there for this to occur?
We were really focusing on Northern Hemisphere because we wanted to focus on the Northern Hemisphere spring and summer, but also in the southern hemisphere, there are strong heat-related impacts. There was a heat wave occurring. For example, Australia was also affected by strong heat. Last year also, I think it was even ongoing until this year. But we really, because of the timing of summer and spring, we really focused on the northern hemisphere.
Recently, you presented the new findings on simultaneous heat waves at the European Geosciences Union press conference in Vienna. Did you get feedback from other scientists? What are they saying?
We have a novelty in our study that we were really investigating the area which was concurrently affected by hot extremes. And often if you're looking on heat waves, we consider only the magnitude or the duration. And this time we really considered the area which was concurrently affected by extreme heat. So in 2018, it might not be that there was one large heat wave, but in many regions at the same time there were heat waves. And I think the scientists, they found our, they were surprised by the results, and they found it really a good idea to look at the area that was concurrently affected by hot extremes.
Yes. Could you just describe one of those heat waves, whether it's 2010 or 2012 or 2018, and talk to us about where the heat appeared, what countries, what regions?
Okay. We were looking in 2018 on hot days, so the days that were much warmer than the 90% of the climatological period. And we focused on key agriculture and densely populated areas in the northern hemisphere because they can be strongly exposed to extreme heat. So the hot days we were considering, they were occurring in the US, in Canada, in many regions in Europe, like in the UK, in Scandinavia, including Finland, Sweden, Norway, and also in Denmark, in the Netherlands, in Germany, in Switzerland, in France, Portugal, also more really to the east in Asia, we were considering Japan and South Korea, where there was a large number of hot days in 2018.
From the Swiss University ETH Zurich, we have been speaking with Dr. Marta Fokel. She is co-author of a new paper still in review about multiple simultaneous heat events that have appeared since 2010. I will put links to an article about this in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Marta, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Okay, thank you. No problem.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock.
The world's upside down, isn't it? It's all run by complete madmen and idiots and basically men who don't know what they're doing. They're just stuffing their pockets.
Let me tell you a story of how we humans are. A friend with arthritis got a prescription for a medication called Diclofen. Rubbed on the skin, it does help stop the pain for a while. Only when checking on the web did he discover that diclofen is absolutely toxic to cats. A woman who applied it to her knees reported her cat died after licking her knees. But it goes much further than that. We may not see vultures much longer due to diclofen being given to humans and to animals. In India, diclofen was given to cows, and it has led to the disappearance of an astounding 99% of India's vultures. That is a giant, unspeakable loss in nature. The unconsumed offal or rotting animals led to a big increase in wild dogs, which brought rabies and fear to children. I think that drug is now banned for veterinary use in India, but did we learn anything after wiping out India's vultures with an unnecessary drug? No. After that, Spain approved diclofen for animal use in 2013. Spain has about 90% of the last vultures of Europe. Here we go again. It's another example of our group insanity. Apparently, we cannot stop killing nature, even when the killing is totally unnecessary. Humans do not even know we are doing that. Take another horrible example. Perhaps you have seen a stunning documentary on the amazing emperor penguins managing to raise their chicks in the harsh conditions of Antarctica. Perhaps your children have seen those penguins in cartoon movies. But the world's second largest colony of emperor penguins has just experienced its third year of what scientists call almost total breeding failure. In the journal Antarctic Science, a new study by the British Atlantic Survey says changes in the ice in this age of global warming threatens to wipe out around 7% of the world's total penguin population in this one area. The emperor penguin colony at Halley Bay looks like it is going extinct. Half a planet away, people are flying and driving around as though we are not responsible for heating up the planet. Our emissions are killing the great emperor penguins. This leads me to another problem that has escaped my best efforts to capture it. I'm talking about ocean warming. About 90% of our excess warming of this planet goes into the oceans. We would be frying right now if that didn't happen. You know water heats slowly and then cools slowly, releasing that heat. I can find scientists who study and explain that the ocean is warming. The World Meteorological Society just released a report saying the top 700 meters of the sea is warming the most. But who can tell what that means when the impacts pop up all over the place, from Antarctic penguin breeding grounds to dying coral off Australia, to bigger storms wiping out Caribbean islands, to Arctic ice threatening the last polar bears as it disappears? Perhaps it's a story that's just too big to tell. According to the latest quarterly report from the Carbon Brief, the first few months of 2019 have set new records for ocean heat content, with the particularly pronounced jump in February and March 2019. Carbon Brief continues, quote, "In many ways, ocean heat content represents a much better measure of climate change than global average surface temperatures. It is where most of the extra heat ends up and is much less variable on a year-to-year basis than surface temperatures. Most years set a new record for ocean heat content, and 2019 has been no exception so far, with the first 3 months showing the warmest OHC since records began. Changes in the amount or rate of warming are much easier to detect in the ocean heat content record than on the surface. For example, OHC shows little evidence of the slowdown in warming in the mid-2000s seen in surface temperature records. It also shows a distinct acceleration after 1991, matching the increased rate of greenhouse gas emissions over the past few decades," end quote. And I have seen scientists, especially from China, suggesting that we should get away from using heating on land temperatures and just measure what is happening in the upper ocean. What I'm hearing is that the current land-based warming of 1 degree over pre-industrial times, accepted by most scientists, is not as reliable as measuring heat changes in the sea. Plus, we have buried massive amounts of heat in the ocean, and that will all come back to life. Will come back in the atmosphere over the next few centuries. So we can set a target of 2 degrees warming, which I think is a dangerous fantasy right now. But whatever goals we set, the ocean will keep returning more and more of our past heat to the atmosphere and our lives, if we still have lives. Here is just another small example. The famous beaches of Mexico's Caribbean coast are being covered by masses of brown, slimy seaweed. It is the Sargasso coming in from the offshore Sargasso Sea areas of the Atlantic. But now, with heated waters in the prime tourist areas, this seaweed is taking over. Despite efforts to clean it up every day, the beaches are littered with smelly, rotting seaweed. Tourist visits have dropped significantly, and that is the only industry locals have to survive on. That is due to ocean warming. Of course, there are likely hundreds of millions of people in the tropics who depend directly or indirectly on money coming from tourism. But that whole industry, the very idea of flying around for pleasure, must die until we reach the times of fossil fuel-free airplanes. One solar plane managed to fly around the world over a period of a year. We could revive sailing ships, which take a month or two to reach the resorts, but in the near term, I'm calling on every one of you to stop that madness. The time of flying anywhere for a vacation is over. It is killing the planet. We are killing a livable climate for fun.
Why ain't you done more about climate change? Emissions are going up and up and up. You better act now, young man, while we still have enough time to do something about it.
I mean, I don't like to preach. My own carbon struggle continues. I prefer to let you come to your own conclusions. But isn't it time, finally now, to talk like this? How can we continue to daydream about our big vacation, which will kill off more life and wreck our kids' future? How can we admire people who do travel and keep silent about what we know? I'm hoping the next conference of the parties, the COP still to come, the big climate meetings, will all be held by video with no one traveling, or at least no one flying. Let's stop this madness.
Now, we don't know if tomorrow is scheduled, so we want to be sure that we have enough money to enjoy our lifestyle today.
Meanwhile, the warming oceans are licking away at the bottom of glaciers at both poles, speeding up the way that they slide into the sea. Arctic sea ice is again at a new record low in January 2019. Antarctic sea ice is shrinking, as reported on Radio EcoShock. Antarctic glaciers are now sliding into the sea. They are unstoppable, as NASA warned a couple of years ago. Glacial melt is now passing simple expansion due to heat of the oceans as a source of sea level rise. According to the Smithsonian Institute, today sea level is 5 to 8 inches, 13 to 20 centimeters, higher on average than it was in the year 1900. The seas are rising faster since 1990, increasing every year, and will continue to rise for the next 1,000 years at least. There is no coastline now, just a temporary place where the ocean is soon to arrive. Coastal real estate markets are just beginning to hear the real news. When you add it all up, the world economy must soon begin to shiver and shake. It must, if we want to survive. As George Monbiot bravely says, unsocial capitalism is killing not just us, but most life as we know it. It is an experiment that has failed. The crucial link for your survival now is not whether you can keep a car or a TV, but whether you will have adequate food and water. Watch the food chain, learn what is happening in world food markets, and start the process of learning to grow and live from local fossil-free food. As you've heard in this show, there could be multiple heat waves at the same time in breadbasket countries, and you need to be prepared for that. I think most of the young people, sad to say, those below 20 years old now, will not live where they are growing up. So much of the world will become uninhabitable. The surviving millions will have to move toward the poles and towards the highlands, as the birds and the fish are already doing. Northern Canada, Alaska, Scandinavia, or Siberia will still be very difficult places to survive, even when the southern lands are roasting and raked by extreme weather events. We could still make it out of this super challenge and survive, but it seems so far Humans intend to learn to swim only when we are drowning. We cannot imagine the real future. Most of us cannot. But some can.
We have come here to let them know that change is coming, whether they like it or not.
There is so much I can say, but despite my decades learning and working on climate change, I cannot say it better than 16-year-old Greta Thunberg. I'm going to read a few words from her speech to the UK Parliament on April 23, 2019. I only dare to speak in her voice because the audio was so poor, interrupted by the flash of press cameras and sounds from the crowd. Greta said, "In the year 2030, I will be 26 years old. My little sister, Beta, will be 23, just like many of your own children or grandchildren. That is a great age, we have been told, when you have all of your life ahead of you, but I am not so sure it will be that great for us. I was fortunate to be born in a time and place where everyone told us to dream big. I could become whatever I wanted to. I could live wherever I wanted to. People like me had everything we needed and more. Things our grandparents could not even dream of. We had everything we could ever wish for, and yet now we may have nothing. Now we probably don't even have a future anymore. Because that future was sold so that a small number of people could make unimaginable amounts of money, it was stolen from us every time you said that the sky was the limit and that you only live once. You lied to us. You gave us false hope. You told us that the future was something to look forward to. And the saddest thing is that most children are not even aware of the fate that awaits us. We will not understand it until it is too late. And yet, we are the lucky ones. Those who will be affected the hardest are already suffering the consequences, but their voices are not heard. Is my microphone on? Can you hear me? Because I'm beginning to wonder. Around the year 2030, 10 years, 252 days, and 10 hours away from now, we will be in a position where we set off an irreversible chain reaction beyond human control. That will most likely lead to the end of our civilization as we know it. That is, unless in that time, permanent and unprecedented changes in all aspects of society have taken place, including a reduction of CO2 emissions by at least 50%. Greta Thunberg is the young stick of dynamite in our deadly carbon dream world. Those words were from her speech to the UK Parliament in April. Find a link to the full text at the Guardian newspaper or in my show blog at ecoshock.org.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This song, We Don't Have Time, is from Sustainable Soundtracks featuring Adam Baptiste with the voice of Greta Thunberg. Find out more at www.wedonthavetime.org or get a link to the video in my show blog at ecoshock.org.
This one goes out to planet Earth. Each one teach one.
Listen, listen, there's a distant sound.
Yeah.
Coming closer soon, it's all around.
It's all around.
Hear me, time is running out.
Come on.
Come on, tell them what it's all about.
Yeah, yeah. We're running out of time, running out of air. Gotta keep it clean, show me you care. Wherever you are, you gotta wake up.
Come on.
We got a job to do, so stand up.
Yeah.
Salute life, not the general. Play fair, with your morals. We can be united as the nations. For our planet, running out of patience.
To act, we got a world to save.
Hey, hey.
Right or wrong, now how will you behave?
Come on.
Do the right thing as they used to say. More than ever, that is true today.
Listen, you
want to be part of the solution. Switch it up for future generations. Level up, stop wasting. You want to know if that's water that you're tasting. Stop playing with our future. My daughter told me if my planet dies, then how would you console me? Show me some responsibility. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right, y'all. We don't have time.
Kids don't usually do what you tell us to do. We do what you do. And since you adults don't give a damn about my future, I won't either.
Together we can do it.
We don't have time to wait.
Come on, come on, let's go! We ain't got no time now.
To ignore the signs,
yeah,
no more.
Yeah, yeah, hey!
Hear me, it's a final call.
Out the planet Earth.
I'm Alex Smith. We'll be back with more scientists and activists next week right here on Radio EcoShock. I hope you will tune in, and thank you so much for listening.
Who would control the global climate?
Because I promise you, I say this to each of you as individuals, I promise you, a day will come when our children and grandchildren will look back and they'll ask one of two questions. Either they will ask, what in God's name were they doing? Didn't they see the evidence? Didn't they realize that four times in 15 years the entire scientific community of this world issued unanimous reports calling upon them to act? What was wrong with them? Were they too blinded and numbed by the busyness of political life or daily life to take a deep breath and look at the reality of what we're facing? Did they think it was perfectly all right to keep dumping 70 million tons every single day of global warming pollution into this Earth's atmosphere? Did they think all the scientists were wrong? What were they thinking? Or they'll ask another question. They may look back and they'll say, how did they find the uncommon moral courage to rise above politics and redeem the promise of American democracy and do what some said was impossible and shake things up and tell the special interests, okay, we've heard you, and we're going to do the best we can to take your considerations into account, but we're going to do what's right.
Al Gore in testimony to the U.S. Congress, March 21st, 2007.
I think we've already entered the era of superfires, both in Canada, continental U.S., Australia, and other areas as well.
If we continue up to, you know, that 3.5 and some say 4 and indeed 6 degrees, the essential thing is this is ultimately, it's not compatible with human existence. That's the raw and the ugly truth of it, and that's why we really do need to do something about it.
Most of the world's airports, in many respects, are at sea level. You find airports everywhere along the coasts of the continents. Countries that can build airports out into the ocean. San Francisco did this. Japan does this. China did it. Honolulu. It's just a number of airports have landed in Sydney where you're just skipping the ocean and then you're on this tarmac. All of those are going to get covered over by even the 3 to 5 foot sea level rise because of storm surge.
Climate change is like the many-headed hydra. We think we know it, but we don't. The Earth is rearranging in all the places humans don't look, at sea, at the poles, deep in the melting permafrost, and in the farthest forest and mountaintops.
As long as I'm in this sinking ship and I have a can, I'm going to start bailing and keep working in that direction.
Radio EcoShock.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
You could see that this is clearly an intelligence operation run with navigating between the private and the public sector in relations to Israel and being domestically unleashed in the United States against PDS activists.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, and this is the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm here with my co-host, Asa Wynn-Stanley. Asa, how are you?
I'm good. Good afternoon or good morning in Berkeley, California.
And it's been, a pretty boring week for you, I imagine. Not much has been going on in your world. Asa, why don't you give us an update on what's been happening or not happening?
Yeah, well, thanks to a blurb by the Jewish Chronicle, a newspaper in the UK, I received 1,200 extra followers on Twitter. So that was nice of them. They called me prominent on Twitter. So
probably not in the context that they were hoping.
So that was nice of them.
Tell us what happened. What happened in the last couple weeks?
Well, we've written an article about it, and the Labour Party has initiated a disciplinary action against me for several of my tweets, which are critical of Israel and of Zionism, the Israeli state's official ideology. So, I mean, being investigated by the Labour Party for my opinions as a journalist, essentially. I'm a member of the Labour Party. I joined in 2016 when there was a coup attempt against Jeremy Corbyn, and I've been reporting on the Labour Party for the last 4 years, really, because since Jeremy Corbyn was running for the first time as Labour Party leader. So last week, a bunch of trolls on Twitter kind of got outraged by the fact that I was a Labour Party member. Not entirely sure why they only just noticed.
Right, it wasn't like a secret that you were a Labour Party member.
No, I mean, I've tweeted about it before. I'm not particularly vocal about being a member, but I have tweeted about it. And they got all outraged. I mean, this is just how the witch hunt has been going, really, for the last 3 years. It's just on and on to the next manufactured outrage after another. So, you know, I was the next one. So what seems to have happened is the Jewish Chronicle, which is a very right-wing and anti-Palestinian newspaper under its editor, Stephen Pollard, hasn't always been that way, incidentally. But, I mean, that's quite important to understand for listeners not in the UK. For example, the Jewish Daily Forward in the States, I mean, for all the terribleness that it has, it's kind of is at least an ostensibly liberal newspaper.
Right.
Is that a fair assessment?
I think so, yeah. I mean, they have some really right-wing opinion writers, but then they have people like Rebecca Pierce, for example, who is a contributor to the Electronic Intifada.
No way in hell would someone like Rebecca Pierce be published in the Jewish Chronicle of today.
Or their writer, Josh Nathan Kazis, who's done some extraordinary
reporting on
like the way that Jewish communal organizations in the States have funded some of the worst Islamophobic anti-Palestinian hate groups, and work directly with the Israeli government. So the Forward has like a lot of things going, and then it has some really right wing bents. And the opinion editor Batya Ungar Sargon, of course, was one of the instigators against the
she's a terrible person.
Yeah, against Congresswoman Ilhan Omar a few weeks ago. So yeah, that's the Forward. But Jewish Chronicle, go on.
One of their reporters tweeted Thursday night, so a week ago from when we're recording, new, it is understood that Asa Winstanley is suspended from the Labour Party pending investigation. Now, I actually still haven't commented on whether it's true or not that I'm suspended from the Labour Party. And I'm still not going to comment on that. But as our colleague Ali reported in his article about this, the Labour Party has initiated a disciplinary procedure against me. And it is for some of my tweets, which are critical of Israel and Zionism. Now, the fact that I learned about this first from Rosa Doherty's tweet, the Jewish Chronicle journalist, shows that the Labour Party, or someone in the Labour Party staff, is sending this information first about disciplinary procedures to journalists before they even telling the people concerned. So, I mean, this is not only about me, right? This is, I mean, in covering this for the last 3 or 4 years, this has been endemic. This has been habitually what's happened. So this is an example of what I mean by a manufactured anti-Semitism crisis. The Jewish Chronicle decided that to make me one of its political targets, and then started, along with with people on the right within the Labour Party, essentially lobbying the Labour Party, saying, "Look, we've discovered this person's a member of the Labour Party, and they're a terrible anti-Semite. What are you going to do about it?" So then the Labour Party has to find some pretext to take some sort of action against me, and then tells the press, sometimes it's Jewish Chronicle, sometimes it's the Sunday Times, it's been other papers, in the past about it. And then the latest terrible example of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party is splurged across headlines. And then people on the left in the Labour Party, in the pro-Palestinian movement in the Labour Party, get upset and outraged about it for a while. Often there's fundraisers for legal support, and then things kind of die down again until the next controversy. So this is designed never to be resolved. It's designed to be a sort of perpetual motion machine of outrage, like manufacturing fabricated anti-Semitism for infinity. That's that's what it's for.
Right.
So it was kind of inevitable that I would become part of this story, really, by reporting on it.
Yeah. And it's meant to wear people down, to make them just so tired of fighting these baseless and ridiculous charges that they just say, okay, fine, I'm not going to talk at all about Palestinian rights anymore. And I'm just going to put my head down and keep doing the work, either as a Labour Party member or as an MP, and you've got me, kind of thing.
And it has an effect. It works, because you can see how Jeremy Corbyn has changed his positions. So when I interviewed him almost 4 years ago, in 3.5 years ago, I suppose, in the summer of 2015, when he was running for Labour Party leader for the first time, we got him to, I got him to say that he was in favor of BDS. You know, I mean, of course he would be. He sort of had some reservations about certain forms of academic boycott, although he endorsed aspects of academic boycott too. And he's now, you know, retreated essentially from that. And he's even retreated from BDS in general, saying he doesn't participate in the BDS movement, only boycott of products from settlements. You know, so these things have an effect. And to pretend otherwise is completely ridiculous and ludicrous. So, I mean, it's quite illuminating with what's going on in America with Ilhan Omar. And it's an exact repeat. Like, it's literally play for play. It's exactly the same. So, you know, my advice for comrades on the American left is do not back down in the slightest. Don't give even the remotest concessions to any of this. Because the moment you do, you see what happens with people backing down. Like with the examples that I've just given with Jeremy Corbyn, because you will feed this for years. It will go on for years. It's designed to never end.
That's right. Well, Asa, are you going to be stopping reporting on Palestinian
rights?
It's
over now.
Totally over. They won.
I regret to inform the losers and the haters that, you know, normal service will be carrying on as always.
Amazing. Well, we'll of course be tracking what's happening to you during this insane manufactured crisis and these really serious and dangerous attacks against you. Obviously, keep us posted on that. But we are going to in a couple minutes we're going to be going to an interview that we did with Professor Hatem Bazian of UC Berkeley. Here in the Bay Area, who was the subject of attacks by groups very close to the Israeli government that have intended to spy on, threaten, and intimidate Palestine rights supporters and supporters of the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS campaign, especially on U.S. campuses, and to get them to shut up and to stop organizing. So just in the past week, we published a really wonderful feature by Kristen Davis Bailey, who has been a longtime member of various different Palestine solidarity organizations. He's one of the founders of Black for Palestine. He was very active in Students for Justice in Palestine when he was a student. And he was reporting on revelations that came out from the New Yorker's reporting on a group called Psy Group. And this organization was basically set up by previous Mossad agents who were kind of tasked with organizing these very shadowy online threats against Palestine rights supporters in the U.S., especially students and professors. And Hatem Bazian was one of the targets of Psy Group. And I wanted to read a little bit from Christian's piece on this. He said that Psy Group, which reportedly ceased operations in 2018 following an FBI investigation into possible 2016 U.S. election interference, reported on previously by the Electronic Intifada, used shadowy and coercive methods to attempt to undermine the Palestine solidarity movement in the U.S. Psy Group raised at least $1.2 million to conduct dark web surveillance, in-person intimidation, online blacklists, and smear campaigns against Palestinian rights activists. According to The New Yorker, Psy Group asked private donors for an additional $1.3 million in funding in 2017 for something called Project Butterfly, and told potential donors that a successful campaign would, quote, make it look as though Israel and the Jewish American community had nothing to do with the effort. The overall goal, according to a company document, was to destabilize and disrupt anti-Israel movements from within. Some donors asked the group to target students who supported BDS campaigns on campuses where their children studied. Project Butterfly concentrated its efforts on up to 10 college campuses, including the University of California, Berkeley. So, Asa, how does Psy Group, how does this these like shadowy you know, web surveillance operations managed and funded by groups very close to the Israeli government kind of fit within this, you know, the context of what's been happening to you and other reporters or anti-Zionist activists in the UK and around the US? How do we see the effects that Psy Group has had on Palestine rights activism?
Well, in a nutshell, what happened with this front organization, is what I consider it, Psy Group, is that Israel's been engaging in a campaign of psychological warfare against US citizens in the US. I mean, that's a line, that's taken from a line anyway, or my sort of summary of a line within Kristen Davis Bailey's article, which is really excellent. And I, if he's listening to this, will you please write for us more?
Agreed.
Yeah. That's it in a nutshell. And there's no doubt to my mind, this very similar things are happening in the UK and probably other countries with strong Palestine solidarity movements. It's listen, I mean, the fact that Psy Group is shut down now, it doesn't really mean much except that it was exposed. I mean, the Israeli government has always acted in this way. It's always acted through front organizations and it's always acted through intermediaries. It's always got wealthy supporters of Zionism from around the world to fund its operations. I mean, for just one example is if you read Seymour Hersh's book about the Israeli nuclear arsenal, the Samson auction, which I highly recommend in general. He talks about how funding for it was to start it up was raised in the US, you know, from rich supporters of Israel in the US, you know, and this was for because you know, there was some controversy on this program, even within the Israeli cabinet. So it was kind of done off the books. And so, like, this is what the Israeli government is doing. And it's quite striking to me from this article how they're working together with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, which is essentially an unregistered agent of the government of Israel, who are working in the US, probably in violation of US law, but they're just being allowed to get away with it. And so, like, it was really illuminating to have our discussion with Hatem, and I actually learned a fair amount from it.
Yeah. Again, check out Kristen Davis Bailey's article on the Electronic Intifada. It's called "Ex-Mossad Agents Harass U.S. Students, BDS Activists." That was published March 9th. Look for that, and we'll also link to that article on the podcast blog post that accompanies this podcast.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Karen Holbert Flynn, president of Common Cause, who examines Attorney General Barr's mishandling of the Mueller report's release and debate on whether or not House Democrats should launch impeachment proceedings against President Trump. Colin Reese, senior campaigner with Oil Change International, who talks about gathering opposition to President Trump's recent executive orders to speed up approval of fossil fuel pipeline and infrastructure projects. And Drew Hudson, a member of the group Beyond Extreme Energy, who talks about BXE's campaign opposing the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's current role as a rubber stamp for the fossil fuel industry. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A week after a military coup toppled Sudan's dictator Omar al-Bashir, activists who had flooded the capital city of Khartoum for months remained in the streets calling for civilian rule, a demand endorsed by the African Union. Protests started in December after Bashir imposed austerity measures and devalued the currency. Opposition activists led by women and students soon called for Bashir to resign. The military council that took over following Bashir's ouster said it would lead a 2-year transition that could end sooner under the right political conditions. The coup leaders are supported by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, who pledged to provide economic aid. The Sudanese Professionals Association, a group that spearheaded the protests, renewed its calls for a civilian-led political transition and called on citizens to continue their sit-in at the army headquarters. The opposition umbrella group known as the Forces for Freedom and Change includes the Sudan Call, the leftist consensus forces, and representatives of civil society. However, after 30 years of division and infighting, alliances and rivalries within the traditional political parties make it harder to organize a truly united front against the military council. Back in 2012, then Newark, New Jersey Mayor Cory Booker appeared on Meet the Press and defended Mitt Romney from criticisms over the Republican presidential candidate's career at Bain Capital, urging President Obama and other Democrats to stop attacking private equity. Despite recent moves to try to distance himself from Wall Street interests, including swearing off corporate PAC money, pledging support for Medicare for All, and running for president this year as an unabashed progressive, questions remain about Booker's relationship with corporate America. In 2018, Booker received major campaign contributions from individuals working in major Wall Street firms such as Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and Prudential Financial, in addition to lobbying firms associated with Big Pharma and pro-Israel PACs. How much influence will these donors have on Booker's positions on the issues? Although he's consistently voted against Wall Street deregulation, the New Jersey senator has sided with Israel-backed legislation against boycotts, divestment, and sanctions, or BDS, and has a mixed record on health care. In January 2017, Booker voted with the Senate GOP majority against an amendment urging the federal government to allow Americans to buy cheaper prescription drugs from Canada. The stench coming from the landfill in West Jefferson, Alabama, northwest of Birmingham, was so bad that you couldn't walk outside without suffering headaches and nausea and being swarmed by insects attracted to the source of the smell, which was tens of thousands of tons of human waste. The landfill, called Big Sky Environmental, sits on the fringes of West Jefferson and is permitted to accept waste from 48 U.S. states. It used a nearby rail spur to import sewage from New York and New Jersey. From the train cars, the waste was transported by truck, which drove through city streets, sometimes spilling dark liquid onto the street on their way to the landfill. Alabama has gained a reputation as America's dumping ground, with toxic waste from across the country typically heaped near poor rural communities, many with large African-American populations. 2 years ago, residents living near the Stone's Throw landfill in Montgomery County claimed the toxic dump there was the cause of chronic illnesses like asthma and cancer, and thus violated the Federal Civil Rights Act. In December, however, the Trump Environmental Protection Agency ruled there was insufficient evidence for the complaint. Now, according to the Guardian newspaper, more than 40 black residents are suing the landfill operator, Advanced Disposal Services, and two water utility companies for allowing heavy metals, E. coli, and hazardous chemicals to leach into the local water supply, which they claim caused their abdominal cancers. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruth Ann Baumgartner.
In the days since Attorney General William Barr released a redacted version of the long-awaited Mueller report, the 448-page document reveals major contradictions between what Mr. Barr told the nation when he released his earlier four-page summary and during a press conference, and what the report actually says. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer charged that Barr deliberately distorted significant portions of Special Counsel Mueller's report in an effort to give the document a positive spin on the president's behalf. The areas where Mr. Barr misled the nation included sanitizing Robert Mueller's conclusion that the Trump campaign had indeed been complicit with Russian interference in the 2016 election, but that those activities fell short of what he defined as coordination. Mueller also directly contradicts Barr's summary to state that he declined to prosecute Trump for obstruction of justice based solely on a Justice Department legal opinion, saying that the Justice Department can't indict a sitting president, and explicitly asserts that Congress should be the body to now determine whether or not President Trump should be held accountable for obstructing justice. Your reporter spoke with Karen Hobart Flynn, president of Common Cause, who examines Attorney General Barr's mishandling of the Mueller report's release, the Democratic Party-controlled House constitutional duty to pursue accountability for presidential misconduct, and whether or not to launch impeachment proceedings against Mr. Trump.
I believe that the Attorney General has diminished the credibility of the Department of Justice, and it is not completely clear to me whether he will be cooperating by providing the unredacted version of the Mueller report, as well as the underlying evidence to Congress and the committees that need to do further investigation. His handling of this was, in my mind, appalling. First, sending a memo describing, and I think, you know, really kind of whitewashing what this report did, and said basically that it was an exoneration of Trump. And in his press conference that he held the morning before the redacted report was sent over to Congress and before reporters had a chance to even read it or the American public, he announced that this was an exoneration of Trump, that Trump fully cooperated with the investigation, which is a complete joke, really had a couple of chances to do PR and messaging that helped Donald Trump brag in both instances, in the initial letter that he sent and this press conference, that it was a complete exoneration, no collusion, no obstruction, and continuing to lie about both the investigation, which was a real and concrete investigation, and also about the outcome of it.
Karen, one of the big debates right now within the Democratic Party, which controls the House of Representatives, is where do they go now? Do they move towards impeachment hearings? Do they further investigate? Do they make calculations that impeachment probably won't pass muster in the Senate, which is controlled by the Republicans, so bypass impeachment? There's a lot roiling within the Democratic Party right now. What's your view of what should take place at this moment?
Without a doubt, an impeachment process is a political process. The power to do this is mandated in the Constitution that the House of Representatives has the ability to conduct an investigation to hold the president accountable because no one is above the law. And so they could begin investigations, impeachment investigations, to look at the issues that have come up in this report, dig deeper to see the underlying evidence. And also there are, and I've seen 10 or 14 other investigations happening. So there is a lot more to come. One of the challenges I think we face and others face that want to take a look at how we bring this administration to justice is that so much of the investigation has happened behind closed doors and the American people haven't seen much of it. And it can be really compelling when you hear someone testify. Think about when Michael Cohen testified about his interactions with Trump and the hush money payments and everything else. That is compelling to hear it from other people. And so I think one of the things that has to happen, and whether they're impeachment hearings or just House oversight, judiciary, and intelligence hearings, they need to be conducting investigations to get more information about what Mueller discovered, have Barr testify to hear about his perspective and why he came out with what he did, why when they were presenting this, Mueller wasn't standing there. And I think it's very important to hear Mueller's perspective of what he's found so that we can get to the bottom of this. And I actually think as they continue to look at more information, including the ongoing investigations, they can make the decision about whether they pursue impeachment. Some have talked about censure. But I think the most important thing is that we do not let this abuse of power and obstruction of justice continue. It gives a green light to others to think they're an imperial president that can ignore our democratic norms and values and institutions. And so that is some of, I think, you know, what leaders in the House are grappling with. In fact, I believe Nancy Pelosi had, you know, a phone call with leaders in the House to be talking through these issues.
That was Karen Hobart Flynn, president of Common Cause. For more analysis and commentary on the debate over pursuing impeachment against President Trump, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In keeping with his long-standing dismissal of climate change as a hoax, President Trump signed a pair of executive orders on April 10th that would increase the speed at which the federal government would approve construction of fossil fuel projects through limiting environmental reviews. One of the orders appears to target the Keystone XL pipeline, declaring that the decision to authorize infrastructure crossing international borders shall be made solely by the president rather than the State Department. While these executive orders are part of a broader effort to use Mr. Trump's executive authority to push through oil, gas, and coal development, if upheld, they could effectively shield the president's actions from review by the courts. One of Mr. Trump's executive orders would limit the ability of states to review and reject pipelines and other projects under a section of the Clean Water Act. States have used that law in recent years to slow or block several pipeline projects across the country. Your reporter spoke with Colin Reese, senior campaigner with Oil Change International, who talks about his group's response to Mr. Trump's executive orders and how lawsuits and public opposition could effectively stop or slow down implementation that would increase the fossil fuel industry's output of climate change-inducing greenhouse gas emissions.
Recently, Trump put out these two executive orders at the behest of his kind of big oil sponsors. We specifically know we've seen records of their calendar meetings with different agencies. We know that he has literally appointed an oil lobbyist now head of the Department of Interior, a coal lobbyist head of the EPA. There is sort of rampant infiltration of the government by literally the oil and gas and coal industries right now. So it's not a particular surprise. But the other interesting point that I like to make when I talk about these executive orders is that they're also a sign that what we're doing is exactly right, as far as those of us who are kind of fighting pipelines on the ground in the states, fighting tooth and nail to keep the Keystone XL pipeline from being built, to keep the Dakota Access Pipeline from being built, to stop these gas pipelines that are crisscrossing New York. The reason that these two executive orders were passed, one deals with cross-border permits and oil pipelines specifically, and the other one deals with water permits at the state level that are, among other things, that are used to permit gas pipeline approvals. And the reason that the industry was so frustrated and kind of begged the Trump administration to put forward these executive orders is because we've managed to stop a bunch of pipelines in the last few years. New York State has stopped the Constitution Pipeline. It has a couple others that are still pending. There's kind of all these important fights that we've won and continued to build power with these fights against pipelines, and that success was actually what drove this action. So it's not a good thing, and I don't want to say that, but I think it is a sign that the strategy is working and that we kind of need to double down and make sure that our governors now stand up, challenge this, that our state attorney generals fight back. We're, of course, going to be in the courts and in the streets pushing back as much as we can.
Colin, as you mentioned earlier, a whole coalition of environmental groups will no doubt challenge these executive orders in court through lawsuits. What are the prospects that the courts, now with many more extremely conservative Trump federal judge appointees, will give these lawsuits a fair hearing and provide some balance here to where the Trump administration wants to go in terms of letting the fossil fuel industry loose?
It's a great question, Scott, and a really valid worry. I am not a lawyer myself, so I can't speak to all of this, but I think I'll just say that there are a few steps before we even get to that point. I think this is sort of a feature rather than a bug of the Trump administration that we've seen over the last few years, is sort of talking a big game, having a good PR setup, having a big launch event for your executive orders with a bunch of labor union folks in the background and oil industry folks and pipeline people, and then not really following through on the things that you say you're doing. So I think the first step is seeing if the agencies even implement these executive orders. It's taken them months in the past. There are some that have never even kind of gotten to the implementation stage. So one of the questions is, are they going to implement it? Do they think it's legally defensible? Are they willing to kind of even put it out there and let it be challenged by us, or do they think it's just too ridiculous on the face? So if we do get through all those pieces and they kind of implement all the pieces that he signed and said he intended to push through recently, then it does get tied up in legal challenges and goes to the court. And as you mentioned, the courts are not always our friends. Certainly, the legal system should not be the only recourse, as biased and prone as most human institutions are. And so I think it's extremely important that we continue to fight in the streets, to fight at the state level, to be pushing back directly against the industry, to continue this campaign in many, many different ways in addition to these legal challenges. As we've seen, Republicans are not really our friends. A lot of Democrats are not our friends. A lot of the political system is not our friends, but we are increasingly seeing people come around. And it's because of the impact of people campaigning on the ground, pushing on local projects. If you're in any of those states that I mentioned, if you're in New York, if you're in surrounding states, if you're in Pennsylvania, if you're in New Jersey, if you're in Oregon, if you're in Minnesota, there are very active fights in Virginia, North Carolina, West Virginia. All of these places and many more have very active fights right now over these permits, pushing Democratic governors to deny them, get involved on a local level, figure out how you can support local campaigns. We have quite a bit of this on our website, and then make sure it gets out there, make sure it's being heard, and make sure that it's very clear sort of what the choices are. The choices are the future wished for by the fossil fuel industry, pushed for by President Trump, sort of laid out on the silver platter exactly as they told him to, or the future is one in which we actually come together as communities, create our own energy future together, democratize and own that and move forward in a way that creates commonwealth for all. So I think we are really at a turning point here, but I have a lot of faith that if we organize together as communities and stand together for our values, that we can really make a difference.
That was Colin Reese, senior campaigner with Oil Change International. Learn more about growing opposition to Trump administration efforts to further deregulate the fossil fuel industry by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The U.S. Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, has the power to approve or deny permits to build interstate gas pipelines and related infrastructure, such as compressor stations and gas export terminals. But in the past 30 years, the agency has turned down just 2 out of 400 applications. For almost its whole existence, FERC has acted as a rubber stamp for the fossil fuel industry, and most of its commissioners come from oil and gas companies, which they return to when their terms expire. One Democratic appointee, Richard Glick, has often opposed new projects due to climate concerns, while the other Democrat, Cheryl LaFleur, has most often, but not always, supported them. Beyond Extreme Energy is a coalition of groups and individuals, mostly along the Eastern Seaboard, working to retire fossil fuels. Over the past 5 years, the group known as BXE has carried out many nonviolent direct actions at FERC. On April 18th, two BXE activists scaled a 25-foot wall at FERC headquarters, sat down behind the awning over the building's front entrance, and dropped a banner reading, "Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, no. Federal Renewable Energy Commission, yes." Despite the response of large numbers of police and a fire department hook and ladder truck, the two men, Ted Glick and Drew Hudson, remained in place for 5 hours. The pair finally came down from their perch on their own, avoiding arrest. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who's a BXE member, spoke with Drew Hudson about his direct action banner drop and what's next in the group's campaign targeting FERC.
Yeah, they actually have a lot of oversight over your utility company. Wherever you live in the country, you know, you pay your monthly utility bill to some company to supply you electricity. And one of the things that FERC already has powers over is regulating the interconnection of those markets and making sure that they function reliably, that you can get electricity every time you turn the switch on. And they also have a hand in controlling some pricing. They don't literally set the price for your power bill. But they're supposed to be looking at how utility markets are run and how they're connected to each other and making sure that consumers get a fair shake. And it would be pretty simple. We've said all along, if FERC would just stop saying yes to every fossil fuel project that comes before it, that would bring up a very logical question: is, well, where are we going to get our power from instead? And FERC has had a number of conferences on grid reliability and renewable energy and the potential for storage to meet more of our electricity needs from storing renewable energy in batteries or in underground systems and all kinds of things. So they have a lot of expertise and a lot of knowledge they could deploy. And so that's why this Federal Renewable Energy Commission idea kind of came up to us when we started talking to folks in Congress about the Green New Deal. We've been calling for years for Congress to hold oversight hearings on FERC. That's something Congress is supposed to do. And like a lot of oversight things in the Trump administration, they haven't done a very good job of it for the first 2 years. But now that Democrats are in control of the Congress, we think there might be an opportunity for some new thinking. And some folks there may be interested in looking at this agency, FERC, and what it's been doing and thinking about changing its mandate, because they do already have some pretty expansive powers to investigate and hold hearings and ask utilities to change their pricing structure and to change their energy mix. And that would fit perfectly with a vision for a Green New Deal. They could get out here and stop approving gas pipelines and start ordering utilities to find more renewable energy, to invest in those sectors, to employ more people in that, and to really jumpstart some innovation in things like big battery storage so that we can save up all the power from solar panels during the day and deploy it all at night when the sun goes down.
So it seems like this transformation from FERC to FREC to an agency that prioritizes renewable energy isn't such a crazy idea then.
It's only crazy if you believe, as FERC seems to at the moment, that the only thing we can do is keep saying yes to the gas industry every time they want to propose a new line or piece of fossil fuel infrastructure.
As part of Beyond Extreme Energy, I was on the ground outside FERC headquarters, and then some of us went into the overflow room to watch the meeting on TV. And, you know, I have to say that I was extremely distressed to hear the commissioners approve not one, but two new liquefied natural gas export terminals on the Gulf Coast.
It was a very dispiriting moment. And really, it does sort of illustrate what this fight about climate justice is all about, because not only did they approve, you know, two new major fossil fuel export projects — this is the whole purpose of these things, is going to be to dig up fossil fuels in America, and that will cause tremendous damage to groundwater and earthquakes and all of the impacts that come from fracking, which is how we get the gas out of the ground. And then we're going to ship it overseas, where it's going to create, you know, misery and destruction in somebody else's country, you know, both from the climate change emissions and from the air pollution when this stuff is burned. And then not only all of that, but the two export terminals were both located in the Gulf of Mexico, which is America's sort of oldest environmental sacrifice zone, and the place where we continue to just shove environmental injustice after environmental injustice on top of some of the poorest and also blackest and brownest bodies in America. And the tradition of poisoning those communities so that mid-Atlantic northeastern gas companies can make a buck continues absolutely unabated and unregarded by FERC, which is just really frustrating and angering and dispiriting at the same time. I think the reason why we take some hope is Commissioners Glick and LaFleur, as you say, have been dissenting more. LaFleur in particular is making her fight kind of about like a process argument. What she seems to want is that there would be an accounting of climate change emissions in the way FERC reviews these projects. So long as the accounting is done, she doesn't mind that it's going to destroy the climate in our common home. She just wants the math to be right, which is not really a totally sensible position to us, but that's what she's saying. But it would be a big change in FERC if we can just get the commissioners to sort of acknowledge that there's a different way of doing business. And that does seem that we're making progress on that front. And ultimately, it will be up to Congress to change their mandate. You know, if we're going to rewrite parts of the Utility Act and the Natural Gas Act, that's going to take new laws and new regulations. And again, that's why we tie it back to the Green New Deal. We're very hopeful and optimistic by all this new energy created by the Sunrise Movement and by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez talking about a Green New Deal, putting this big, bold vision forward. It's not perfect yet, and it needs a lot of development and detail added in. And we hope that this reform of FERC into FREC can be one part of that conversation and get moving in the next few years, because we only have about 12 years to act.
That was Drew Hudson, a member of the group Beyond Extreme Energy. Learn more about BXE and their clean energy fossil-free campaigns by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WBCR in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, WZMO in Marion, Ohio, KMUD in Garberville, California, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Ruth Ann Baumgartner, Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Wars Against Assange. The intrepid journalist and author Glenn Greenwald, in his 2014 work, No Place to Hide, offers a damning portrait of the U.S. media, too long trained to worship at the altars of power as agents of first attack against those journalists who dare to question or expose imperial edicts or escapades. Indeed, Greenwald himself details how establishment reporters begin their attacks by questioning both his status as a journalist and then one's psychological wellness. Now, today, we see the same tactics deployed against Julian Assange of WikiLeaks fame. Assange and his collective, WikiLeaks, have been whistleblowers and transparency activists determined to bring light on government activities everywhere. Ecuador's decision to withdraw its welcome to Assange has exposed him to the venom of the American government, largely for showing U.S. atrocities back in Iraq during the war. In 2008, Greenwald writes, U.S. Army secret reports called WikiLeaks, quote, an enemy of the state, unquote, showing plans to destroy the group. And although Assange didn't work as a reporter, he compiled great amounts of data and shared it with great newspapers, which, while publishing his data, still tried to demonize him, denounce him, and question his sanity. Assange's work has shown how governments, including the U.S., really work. For that, he has earned high praise. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Been held in Pennsylvania prisons, stemming from the August 8, 1978 confrontation between MOVE and the city of Philadelphia. Nine MOVE men and women faced an unprecedented and facially illegal sentence of 30 to 100 years for a third-degree murder conviction of a cop that more likely than not died from what was a classic case of so-called friendly fire. That said, 2018 and 2019 marked a sea change in this MOVE case, for MOVE members began to come home. Two of them, Mike and Debbie Africa, were MOVE mates, as in man and wife. On April 7, 2019, Mike and Debbie formally married in the presence of their children and grandchildren. Also there were friends and supporters from far and near. Before they both were sent to faraway state prisons, I interviewed them for public radio. I remember quite distinctly talking to Mike, and I asked about Debbie. He looked at me in that peculiar amber-colored stare and said, I'm going to write her every day. It stunned me. I said, every day? Mike repeated, move, every day. This was his woman, he explained. So, every day. Today, they live
as husband and wife in a house that their son, Mike Jr., built 40 years. Today, Mike's once black hair is silvery, framing his bearded, dark face. Debbie, astonishingly, looks like a teenager. The bricks and bars of unjust encagement did not diminish their love. If anything, it has enriched it to show us all a move love story as real as steel. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Another struggle. My beloved friends, I would be remiss if I did not take this opportunity to mention my dear big brother, Keith Cook. Happy birthday, brother. We gather again another day in another year, another battle, and yes, another battle won. Thanks to you, the people, we, you and I, have battled in city streets and in rural courtrooms in this struggle for freedom. But how about the struggle for life itself? When I was on death row, facing death warrants with dates to die, you took to the streets of over a dozen cities to say no. Your simple yet powerful no stopped the hand of the executioner and opened the door to life. And when I was sent to another toxic site called a prison, and my health crashed, and I came closer to death than any time I was on death row, you stood in the snow at the gates of the prison, at the parking lot of the hospital, demanding I receive good treatment and care. You, the people, stood with me when I was unconscious in a diabetic coma, and you filled every courtroom available to demand freedom and justice. What a movement this is. We are on the move for real, and we still are today. What is behind such a movement as this? The answer is as simple as it is profound. Love. I am your brother, and you, all of you, are my family. You are my sisters and my brothers, my aunts and uncles, my people. To thank you, you who've done so much for so long, seems so small, and yet I thank you all. Thank you for radiating so much love over this long struggle. We're not done. We have more to do. We have work to do, yes. But before us also stands justice and freedom. So in all the ways I can, please allow me to say, En Kikuyu,
Degu, in Somali, Mahasinet, in Arabic, Shukran, in Swahili, Asante San, in Chinese, Xiexie, in Japanese, Arigato Gozaimasu, in French, Merci, in German, Danke, in Spanish, Gracias, and in Ebonics, good looking out, y'all. I thank you all for all you've done and for what we are about to do. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, The Michael Slate Show.
Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a powerful show for you today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Trevor Timm, a co-founder and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. He's a journalist, activist, and lawyer, and he'll talk about the indictment of Julian Assange and the next dangerous steps in Trump's war on the press. We're also going to be featuring a few other little messages inserted here and there, so stay tuned for that. But opening the show up, I am really I'm eager to get into this one. We're going to be talking with Jason Stanley, philosophy professor at Yale University and author of How Fascism Works. Now, Jason Stanley's parents survived the Holocaust in Germany, though millions of people did not. And he has spent the last 10 years studying fascism. He wants to scare us all, as someone said. I actually think he wants to ring the bell. And I like that Spike Lee film, Ring the Bell, and shouting to people, wake up, wake up, wake up. And he's here to talk with us about Donald Trump, the rise of fascism, what it means, and how people should be reacting. So, Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Sure. Let's jump into this because I have 100 questions for you, okay?
Shoot.
Okay. You know, I saw a clip in an event you did in Chicago, and you talked there. You started with a story about your father sitting you down and telling you about the reality of America and the America First movement. And, you know, I guess actually I hadn't been studied up on all this in the America First movement and the relationship between that and what your dad was telling you and what's going on in the country today. Let's talk about that.
So we have a president who's explicitly referencing the America First movement. If you look at history, if you look at, say, Bradley Hart's recent book, Hitler's American Friends, it's got like five chapters, I think, in it. One of the chapters is on the America First movement. The Nazis thought the America First movement and its representative, Charles Lindbergh, its spokesperson, was their main hope in the United States. I mean, we had a very healthy fascist movement. It obviously had clear links to a homegrown movement, the Ku Klux Klan, whose ideology is very much overlaps with German fascism. And we had this long history of white supremacy, white nationalism. I mean, it's not a history. It's our present. It's something that the United States always struggles with. And Charles Lindbergh writes in the Reader's Digest that it's time to build our walls, build our ramparts high to protect the white race against the Mongol horde, against the Persian horde, the Arab horde, you know. This is a long history of racial demagoguery against non-whites, and that's what we're tapping into in the current moment.
Yeah, you know, it's very heavy because it's like there's that, what you're talking about in terms of this long history, and then there is the reality of today, which it really struck me because this, the aspect of people actually needing to know that what is the history of fascism and what it is in the U.S. and the fact that it isn't something foreign. It has a long and deep history. But the problem is that there's, you know, people don't realize even in this sense. I mean, I was – one of the things that really surprised me in reading your book was you made a point that actually it's not like the U.S. is free from all this or is just following what happened in Germany and other places, but that actually
– vice versa.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Germans were deeply influenced by the U.S. case. I mean, people don't understand what an outlier the United States was with its one-drop rule about that you were not white, you were black if you had one drop of blackness. As James Whitman discusses in Hitler's American Model, the Nuremberg lawyers carefully studied our anti-miscegenation laws and based the Nuremberg laws upon them, although they decided that one drop was untethered from reality and went instead with one-eighth. You're Jewish if you're one-eighth Jewish. So our racial laws were even too extreme for the National Socialists. Now, of course, time has changed, and we've fought. The story of America is the story of our struggle with white supremacy, and it's always a difficult struggle, and it's very slow movement and slipping back. Look at the PBS documentary Reconstruction. I mean, I was taught in school that Reconstruction failed. After the Civil War, they give 4 million black people the vote, and then suddenly there are black congressmen and senators and people in the state legislatures, and they panic and they remove the vote. And I was taught that was because black people couldn't self-govern. So we have this long history, and what we're seeing with Trump is an aspect. Trump is very American, but he's also very fascist.
Yeah, we're going to get into that in a minute, because there's a couple of other things I wanted to ask you first. You know, this thing that what you're starting to talk about, and the whole idea that, look, for me, it was really interesting in reading your book. It was, and I really recommend that people get this book. It's well worth sitting down, reading it, and rereading it. It's Jason Stanley, How Fascism Works. You know, one of the things that really struck me there was that there really is this sort of all the various structural problems in the U.S. and how that actually brought people forward, not in a way to actually deal with all this stuff, in a way that could actually, you know, be, I don't know, whatever you would call it, digging in to try and do things in the right way and get, you know, get all this other stuff settled. It actually, you have people, the structural problems in the U.S. are bringing forward people that are turning to, helping them turning to fascism, which is really, you know, that is something I think people don't understand here.
Yeah, I mean, this is very clear in the literature on European fascism. Hannah Arendt's Origins of Totalitarianism, Chapter 10, is all about how fascism emerges when people become lonely, when you break down labor movements, when you break down movements that bring people together to better their lives. Then when they become lonely and isolated due to the deprivations of capitalism, then they turn for solace to identity movements that give them fake hopes of meaning. I mean, I don't think the thing about fascism is it's not good for white people. You know, it's not good for the people that it claims to be good for. As Hannah Arendt says, you know, fascism, claims to advance the race, but in fact, it's just advancing the interests of those who are making these false promises. But those false what happens in these moments when people are isolated and afraid about their economic insecurity is that they desire to see some kind of victory, and they'll sacrifice their own well-being if they think that their enemies, the liberals, the elites, are being humiliated and are being aggravated. So that's fascist politics. Fascist politics says we're not going to give you anything. You're not going to get anything out of this, but what you will get is we're going to torment the people you hate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's jump into this, the structure of fascism and why it's so dangerous. I mean, that's something I think people really need to understand pretty deeply.
Right. So my book is divided into 10 chapters. Each chapter covers a different aspect of fascist politics. And for me, you know, the United States is not governed like it's not a fascist government right now. We have elements of that with our prison industrial system, with the carceral state. But we're not a fascist country by any means. But we're talking about political tactics. Fascism is best thought of as a set of political tactics that breaks down democratic ideals. Let's begin with what democratic ideals are. Democratic ideals are liberty and equality. And both of those are based on truth. If you've been lied to, nobody thinks the people of North Korea are free. They've been lied to, so that's why they're not free. They'll vote for Dear Leader every time because they've been lied to. Liberty requires truth. Equality requires truth because speaking truth to power is how you equalize. So a democratic culture requires people to have respect for the truth because that's how you equalize. So it requires, like, if a very powerful person lies and someone says, "You're lying," that very powerful person will be humiliated, and if they lie too much, they won't be able to participate in public life. If you lose that, you lose your democratic culture, because then a powerless person can't call out a powerful person. So let me start by running down quickly the 10 chapters. The first tactic is the mythic past. All of fascist tactics are based on a big lie, because that's the way to get you to detach from the truth. So the mythic past, we were once great, but we've been humiliated on the national stage. So you could see President Trump did this in the 2016 election. Obama bowed and scraped. He didn't throw American power around. He humiliated us. We're going to return to our greatness. We were once great, you know, wink, wink about when that once was. Propaganda. There's a certain kind of propaganda that is very clear in fascism when things mean they're opposite. Like, all fascist campaigns are anti-corruption campaigns. Even though the fascists themselves are more corrupt than anyone else, they tar their opponents with corruption because they say this is useful for many reasons, but corruption means the wrong people are in charge. Chapter 3 is anti-intellectualism. You attack the press and the universities. So you should always worry when there's a systematic attack on the universities for being left-wing ideological indoctrination centers. So you attack the intellectual bastions, the press, for peddling leftism and liberalism under the guise of objectivity. You attack the universities for being like dens of Marxism and cultural Marxism. In Hungary, they just shut down the best university in Hungary, Central European University, for gender ideology and liberalism. So you always have to worry when there's a big attack on the universities and the press. Chapter 4, unreality. You float conspiracy theories. My first New York Times piece in 2011 was about birtherism, because knowing the history of fascism, that panicked me. There's a way that conspiracy theories work. All the evidence against the conspiracy theories is actually treated as evidence for them. So the way the Nazis floated the protocols of the Elders of Zion, the Jews own the presses, they run the universities, they run the film and theater industry. And then when the presses refused to report on the protocols of the Elders of Zion, that was more evidence. Look, the press is not reporting that the Jews run the press. That just shows the Jews run the press. Similarly, President Trump in 2012 said, you can tell CNN is owned by Obama because they're controlled by Obama because they don't report on birtherism. So unreality, you destabilize people. So nobody knows what the truth is anymore, and they forget the truth. And they're like, I don't care about the truth. I know my guy is lying, but he's my guy. He's us. And his lies drive the other side crazy, and that's what I like. You know, so that's the fascist political sphere. It's just us versus them. Reality's irrelevant. Chapter 5 is hierarchy. You know, equality is a myth. Feminism is not seeking equality. It's seeking to take over. Black Lives Matter is not seeking equality. It's seeking to take over. Black people are seeking to take over. They don't want equality. So you represent the dominant group feels victimized. Trump supporters think the most victimized group in America are white Christians. So that goes into chapter 6, victimhood. You have this incredible tapping of victimhood of the dominant group. The Nazis were like, the Germans are the most persecuted people in the world. We lost our empire. So you have this sense, you cultivate the sense that the persecuted people who are losing their traditions are the dominant group. And what are they victims of? Chapter 7 is law and order. They're victims of crime, of gangs, because those foreigners, and they're bringing in crime and drugs and gangs. So in Austria, Kickl, the far-right minister, he went around and told the police stations they're not allowed to talk to the mainstream press unless to report rapes of Austrian women by immigrants. So you create panicked fear about gang members and rapists, and that leads to the next chapter, which is sexual anxiety. You know, what crime do they do? Well, they do the crime of, they're rapists. We have to protect their women, our women, and that's why we need a strong leader, because the strong leader is going to build a wall and protect our women from the foreigners. And you raise panic about homosexuality. You raise panic about turning boys into girls, because it's manlyhood that's prized in fascist politics. It's patriarchy. And then, you know, the first real fascist politics we had in recent years was Sarah Palin. So that hit the Chapter 9, Sodom and Gomorrah. The cities are the places of decadence and liberalism. That's where everyone mixes together. Chapter 2 of Mein Kampf is called Mein Time in Vienna. And he says, in Vienna, there were foreigners everywhere, foreign languages, and Jews, and more Jews. So the hated outgroup always lives in the cities. Think of what the expression inner city means in America. Cities are where black people live. It's where the immigrants live. And so you create the real Americans live in the countryside, rural versus urban divide. And chapter 10 is called Arbeit macht frei, which was emblazoned on the gates of Auschwitz. Work shall make you free. Time and time again, the outgroup is always lazy. They're drains on the state. And you need to make them work for free in order to earn a work ethic. And that is at the heart. So that's why the idea in Nazi Germany was that Jews were lazy and never did any work. And they just got money because the government gave them, they worked in banking and they just got money from interest and just were lazy. And you had to force them to work to give them a work ethic. And that's what is happening in our prison system right now. And then you target labor unions because labor unions, you know, are about, you know, making workers' lives easier. But you need to break down labor unions because labor unions forge connections across racial divides.
Yeah, this is incredible, actually. And let me make a quick announcement here. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Jason Stanley, who is the author of the book, How Fascism Works. So let's get back into it. Now, Jason, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, too, and you've been hitting it some, but there's this point about why exactly this is so dangerous, you know, because you're thinking like, okay, you go through this, you have Lindbergh, all these people early on talking about fascism. Fascism raises its head, you know, throughout the decades that we've been around, that we've been alive over, you know, since the 1920s all the way up or 1930, you have, who was it? Is it Bannon that talked about it's going to be a good year because it's a lot like 1930, something like that.
Said, yeah. He said, we're going to, in a Hollywood Reporter interview, he said it's going to be exciting like the 1930s. Yeah. Now, he's always winking. So, yeah, that's the decade he goes back to, and that's the decade where the United – now, it's tricky because Bannon has plausible deniability. He'll say, I meant the New Deal, but I'm skeptical that he meant the New Deal.
Yeah, I think you're right to be skeptical. It's sort of – yeah. But the thing is like when you – and that gets into this character of the fascist tactics. And, you know, it is really – there's something that you keep bringing up in your book that really struck me, that fascism seeks to replace truth by power and that there's a very particular method to doing that. Let's talk about that.
So – the method is you get people, you try to replace, so truth balances out loyalty. If we recognize the truth, if we recognize facts, so I don't mean like a deep truth. So people think that the Russian language makes a distinction between deep truth and truth. So that's why that covers propaganda. You lie, but you lie to reveal a deeper truth. I'm talking about just facts. So the enemy of fascism is just facts, just ordinary facts. Because ordinary facts, if everyone has loyalty to ordinary facts, then, you know, it's hard to get away with stuff. They're just ordinary facts. And you have to have, a democratic culture requires that people are humiliated when they lie about ordinary facts. But what you try to do is you try to say, look, the whole system is corrupt. Everybody's lying. Think of Fox News's slogan, old slogan, fair and balanced. Everyone knew Fox News was not fair and balanced. The point of that slogan was to suggest that no one is fair and balanced, that Fox News is just as fair and balanced as everyone else, meaning not fair and balanced at all, because everyone is corrupt, everyone is lying. So you break down trust. You break down trust between citizens. So everyone is just like, okay, I don't know what's true anymore. I don't even care what's true. I just care about my guy winning, and I care about my guy winning and humiliating those liberal cosmopolitan elites and making them feel miserable, what we call owning the libs. And if you go back throughout fascist politics to the 1930s, to the German and Italian fascist movements, that's what it was about. It's about humiliating the elite. It was about bringing them down and, you know, and doing it in the service of your guy gaining power. And so it's like following sports teams. Sports is healthy because it takes away our fascist inclinations and focuses them on something it's fine to root for. It's totally fine for me to be like a total supporter of the New York Knicks because, you know, painful as it is in recent years, you know, that's my team. But that's not the attitude you want to bring to politics. The Democratic Party is not your team. The Republican Party is not your team. The truth is your team. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to raise conspiracy theories to try to humiliate the opponent, to try to just tar them with the worst things ever, and just just make politics into spectacle and show instead of, that's the other thing that we find. So you find Arendt talking about that all the time. She said, in fascism, people are glued to the screen. They're no longer, the news is no longer the news. The news is entertainment. The news is like, what's happening now in the ever crazy turmoil of the administration? Who's in? Who's out? And then no one is following anymore. They get addicted to this like spectacle of excitement. And then, you know, instead of like the boring policy of healthy democratic give and take.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things as you're talking, I kept going back to this, where you get, you know, you talk about in the book, you talk about, you know, Hitler and value comes from victory and struggle, as you've been pointing to, but that also that if you want to get rid of political equality, you actually, this is what you do. You get rid of people's respect for the truth, which is really an interesting thing to posit.
Absolutely. The truth is much more important than people realize, and people are giving it up just to like own the libs far too easily. You know, Trump supporters understand he's lying constantly, but think it's cool. They think it's cool because it you know, triggers the libs. But, you know, if we all step back, Trump supporters and non-Trump supporters, and say, how about we go back to a culture where we just focus on the truth and it's not about, like, humiliating people anymore, because that's not a politics, actually. Politics should be like, here's this. You know, let's talk about a $1 wage raise. Let's talk about the weekend and how we're losing the weekend. Like, I kind of like the weekend. It took the unions a long time to get us the weekend. Let's hold on to the weekend. You know, and it, to get people back to that level and to get people back to respecting the truth, it's a humble thing. It's a little thing, but it's the center of democratic culture.
Mm-hmm. Now, you think about this. It's, you know, a lot of the things that you're talking about, you also go into a section in your book where you talk about that thinking of the normalcy of fascist ideology, you know, that there's a normalization of that going on. And it's very dangerous. And if you think about that, you bring up the term American exceptionalism, and it's constantly brought up generation after generation. And this is very dangerous.
Very dangerous. Very dangerous. So part two of Hannah Arendt's Origins of Totalitarianism is called imperialism. M.A. Césaire in Discourse on Colonialism speaks regularly about, he says, Hitler's the worst person on earth, not because of what he did, but because of who he did it to, Europeans. He was doing to Europeans what the Belgians had done in the Congo when they killed 10 million people, like imperialism. And Hitler, of course, was infuriated, as Du Bois and The World in Africa brings out, was infuriated by the loss of the German colonies in Africa. Imperialism, the idea that the world is yours, is a very dangerous thing. So 9/11 really triggered a lot of what's happening now, because 9/11 was, we lied ourselves, we got comfortable lying ourselves into a colonial war, we sold ourselves on oh, we're spreading democracy. And here's the thing, I mean, Trump was very sophisticated about this, and I respect him immensely for the intelligence this took. He said, we're not good, look at the Iraq war. So that always happens. When you become hypocritical with your colonialism, when it becomes just too obvious that you're not spreading democracy, you're in fact crushing people under your boot, then someone is going to come and say, hey, crush, that's what we do. We crush people under our boot. And that's fascism. Mm-hmm.
You know,
so
what
imperialism leads directly to fascism. The Iraq war led directly to our moment.
Boy, that's pretty heavy. Wow. Tell me this. This thing you talk about in the book about fascist inversion and ideas used to undermine themselves. And then I was thinking about that whole process actually can be used to undermine the entire society. You know, these anti-corruption campaigns, the unreality you referred to earlier. And then one something that you also talk about, which we'll get into in a minute, but the victimhood that's actually been really out there now. So let's just first talk about this fascist inversion. What do you mean by that? And why is it so dangerous?
So remember, there was a Saturday Night Live early on in the Trump administration where they had the Breaking Bad actor, played the Walter White character, come and as the new head of the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, as a joke, you know, because Trump kept on appointing people who were the opposite of their agencies. Mick Mulvaney was running the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Everyone running, he put Rick Perry as the Secretary of Energy. I believe it's Secretary of Energy. The he put people who wanted to dismantle the very agencies they were running as head of the agencies. So they were, he was inverting everything. So fascists run. So I talk about the example. I mean, this inversion point is familiar from literature. George Orwell's 1984, War is Peace. So think about, do you know what the name of Guantanamo Bay is? Camp Justice. Mm. So this inversion where you represent things as their opposite. So how was Trump able to run an anti-corruption campaign? I mean, the New York Times investigation revealed the depths of his corruption, of his business corruption. So how is he able to run this anti-corruption campaign? Well, he's able to run it by painting the system as corrupt and rigged. And to be honest, the system had a lot of was pretty corrupt and rigged. But that's very dangerous when that happens. When the system is, when you can paint the system as corrupt and rigged, then you can run. Then the corrupt candidate becomes like the authentic candidate. He's the one who's openly corrupt, and everyone's like, well, he's obvious. He's not hiding anything. He's openly corrupt. And so they can be the anti-corruption candidate. But it's a joke. Then they run and then they go into office. He's representing the little man. He has a $1.5 trillion tax cut for the oligarchs that fund him and himself. So everything means it's opposite, but it's fine because he's triggering the lips.
Mm-hmm. Boy, all right. I have a couple more questions here for you. And when we're talking about this, and you're, and you know, it's part of this thing of, I don't know. It's sort of like the, you know, you've just been talking about a little the politics of fascism, of pollution and corruption. But there's another thing that actually sticks out really, really sharply in relation to Trump and fascism and the situation of people in this country and in the world right now. And in particular, I was really intrigued by this thing of Trump and young black men who by their existence, their very existence, are violations of law and order, labeled rapists or whatever. Young black men are targets under this fascist stuff.
Right. So things don't mean – under fascism, things mean their opposite. They don't mean – so law and order doesn't mean law and order. So as I talk about in the book, when Jeff Sessions in November 2016 said, you can tell from Trump's response to the Central Park 5 case that he's going to be a law and order president, what was meant by that? The Central Park 5 were five completely innocent young black men who were arrested for a crime there was no, they did not commit, and every possible, there was no physical evidence connecting them to the crime. There was the sperm found there was later shown to be the sperm of a convicted rapist who was on a spree at the time. So they were completely innocent, and they got a settlement from New York City. And Trump said, no, they're guilty. New York City shouldn't have paid the settlement. So what does it mean that Sessions said, oh, he's a law and order president? Law and order is punishing, is making sure that people who are guilty for the crimes face, that society is protected from them and we do something about that situation. It doesn't mean punishing the innocent for crimes they didn't do. Well, law and order under fascist politics means the outgroup, the young Hispanic men, young black men, they are by their very nature violations of law and order. They're criminals. The Nazis, too, painted the German Jews as criminals. When the Nazis ran, they said, we're going to imprison all the criminal Jews. And many Jewish people said, okay, they're not going after me. But it turned out they meant people with traffic tickets, speeding tickets, exactly what's happening with immigrants right now.
Mm. All right, one last question, and this is one that actually I think is – I think it's imperative for people to pay attention to. It's the chapter Arbeit macht frei. And I wanted to ask you about that because it's actually something that I think in some ways brings together everything that you've just been talking about. So let's get into that.
So Arbeit macht frei is about the fact – so fascism is based on social Darwinism. So social Darwinism is the view that value goes with whoever – with the winner. There's winners and you always got to – people are channeling social Darwinism when you have politicians talking about winners and losers. If you hear a politician talking about, well, there's winners and there's losers and I don't like the loser, that's social Darwinism. That's the idea that value only goes with the winners. If you want a good, handy mnemonic to realize how bad that is and how dangerous it is, think of the Nazi T4 program where they gassed the disabled. Why did they gas the disabled? Because they were the Nazis held they had no value because they couldn't do hard work. So they couldn't fight in a competitive market. So social Darwinism is at the core of Nazism. Now, fascism is not social Darwinism of the individual. So economic libertarianism is social Darwinism of the individual. It, too, I believe, is a dangerous doctrine, but it's an acceptable doctrine to have in a free society. You know, libertarians are anti-fascists because they restrict their social Darwinism to the individual. Fascists say certain groups have more value than other groups. Americans have more value than non-Americans. Whites have more values than blacks. Jews have more values than Palestinians. That's the sort of social Darwinism of the group that you find in fascist thinking. And the idea is, and then there's this fiction that there's this hierarchy of value that's been created by hard work. The in-group, the German ideology was that Germans were hard workers, and they worked hard, and Jews were lazy, and they lived off interest and banking, and so you had to force them to do free labor. So you can distinguish the valuable group, because they're hard workers, from the lazy people. And the lazy people have lesser value. And that's the structure of the hierarchy. The lazy people are rapists and criminals, and they're lazy. The valuable people are hard workers and law-abiding. And that's how you construct the value. And labor unions, they try to make it easier. And we don't want to make the workers' lives easier, because hard work gives you value. Now, in fact, hard work is not at the center of liberalism. Like, it's not the case that you have value because you're better at working longer hours. You have value in liberalism because you are a human being worthy of dignity.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jason. Anything you'd like to add before we leave?
No, I think that's how fascism works covers it, and you've done a great job of asking about its themes.
Thank you, man. I really think people should get this book, check it out, read it, pass it around. Very important, especially in this time that we're living in. So, Jason Stanley, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Michael.
All right, take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Jason Stanley, philosophy professor at Yale University and author of How Fascism Works. Jason Stanley's parents survived the Holocaust in Germany, though millions did not. He has spent the last 10 years studying fascism, and he's produced an incredibly important book that people should definitely check out. Now, for a further understanding of the fascism of the Trump-Pence regime, its roots in the history of this country, and why it's come to the fore at this time, there's an unparalleled resource in this talk by Bob Avakian, The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. And I also want to play a clip from Bob Avakian and another talk about why we need an actual revolution and how we can really make revolution. So check this out.
So let's get deeper into what we need to do now. Let's go back to the crucial point that we need to be serious and scientific. A scientific approach and method leads to the understanding that the basis for revolution lies not in what most people are thinking or doing right now or at any given time, but in the deep and defining contradictions of the system. What is concentrated in the five stops and all the terrible suffering to which this system subjects millions and billions of people, which cannot be eliminated within this system. But this revolution will not be brought about magically or just by the way this system causes people to suffer. This revolution must be consciously and systematically built for from here forward, with ever-growing numbers of people, first in the thousands and ultimately in the millions, who are brought forward into the organized ranks of the revolution to actively work for this revolution. How we can win lays out the plan and the means for how we can make this real. First, it is important to understand that although it is true, as I have said in the New Communism, that revolution cannot and will not be made just by spreading the idea of revolution around and perhaps getting some positive responses, thumbs up. At the same time, however, it is also true that spreading the word about this revolution can itself be very important revolutionary work, an important part of building the movement for revolution. The fact is that among those who really need to know about this, including those who most desperately need this revolution, very few have even heard about it. And they are living with the belief that this world as it is the only one that's possible. And for many, this means that on top of being subjected to continual brutality, degradation, and torment, they are suffocated by the lack of hope. Raising people's sights to the possibility of a radically different world can not only bring hope to people on a scientific basis, but can also awaken a potentially powerful force for the revolution that could make this hope a reality. For these reasons, we need to be on a mission to spread the word, to let people know that we have the leadership, the science, the strategy and program, and the basis for organizing people for an actual emancipating revolution. Here again is the importance of the point I emphasized earlier about the great strengths we do have and what is still missing. Masses of people who catch the worst hell under this system, and those who were sickened by the endless outrages perpetrated by this system, who need to be brought forward wave after wave and develop into conscious revolutionaries and revolutionary leaders. Spreading the word, particularly as this is done together with others in a planned, systematic way, can be an important step in joining the organized ranks of the revolution and taking part in the process of building the revolution. A crucial next step in making this revolution real is that thousands need to get organized into the ranks of the revolution now, while millions are being influenced in favor of this revolution. Getting organized into the ranks of the revolution means acting together with others in a unified way, as an organized force, guided by the strategic plan and leadership for the revolution, building the revolution among broader masses of people, while also getting deeper into the principles, methods, and goals of this revolution, the basics of which are concentrated in the points of attention for the revolution. A key form of revolutionary organization are the revolution clubs, which live by, propagate, and fight for those points of attention. The core of the revolution clubs are people deeply committed to revolution who closely follow the leadership of the Revolutionary Communist Party, which has the basis in the new communism to provide overall leadership for the revolution. But the revolution clubs also need to reach out to and involve growing numbers of people who are new to the revolution. The revolution clubs are a means through which people can take part in and powerfully represent for the revolution in an organized way as they learn more about the revolution and advance toward joining the party. Networks of people working together to spread the word about and organize people into the revolution need to be built and expanded in all parts of the country and linked together. In areas where the party and the revolution clubs have not yet established an organized presence, or in circumstances where people have not yet come into direct contact with this organized presence of the revolution, but have become aware of the core principles and goals of the revolution, they should reach out to and involve others they can draw forward around those core principles and goals. They should link up with the central leadership of the revolution for assistance and direction in organizing a revolution club among the people they are bringing into the revolution on the basis of the points of attention for the revolution, which are included in the pamphlet How We Can Win and are posted at revcom.us. A crucial connecting link in all this is the party's website, revcom.us, and newspaper Revolution, which sharply expose the crimes of this system, scientifically analyze why it cannot be reformed, and give guidance and direction for people to work in a unified way for the revolution. In everything we do, it needs to be kept clearly in mind and boldly put forward to people that whatever part of the country we are in, and whatever the size of our forces at any given time, we are doing all this as part of a national movement, together with people in other parts of the country, aiming to impact all of society and building a revolution to overthrow the whole system with the whole world in mind. An important principle and method in organizing people into the revolution is the understanding that while revolution requires serious commitment, people's level of commitment will, at any given time, essentially correspond to and be grounded in what aspirations have been awakened or brought forward in them, and what they are coming to understand is required in relation to that. And this commitment should proceed from what people themselves have been won, yes, through struggle, even at times sharp struggle, to see as a necessary and essential contribution to the revolution. People can start with basic tasks that they can readily carry out and feel confident doing, which make a real contribution to building the revolution. And they can learn to take on more responsibility as they gain more experience and a deeper understanding. The important thing is that they are part of the process of building the revolution together with others. These principles and methods should be kept clearly in mind and applied at all stages of people's involvement with the revolution to enable them to continue in advancing in understanding and commitment.
All right, welcome back. That was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, on what we need to do now from his recent talk, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. And when you're thinking about this, okay, when you're thinking about what you just heard from Avakian, and then think back again, too, on the conversation we just had with Jason Stanley, all about fascism and how fascism is, you know, in my mind, fascism is like, look, we're living in a fascist country right now. We're living in a fascist country that is consolidating its fascism on every front and every day, every move that Trump makes and all these people, that's where they're going. That's what they're doing. And you have to listen to this. You have to listen to what Avakian's saying, what Jason was saying. And then you have to make a decision about what you're going to do about this. All right. And that's extremely important. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with our next guest. And our next guest is Trevor Timm, Executive Director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. So don't miss that. All right, welcome back. Yeah, and that was Function Underground with We the People and various other people in it. All right, and the thing just gets me. It just sends me someplace else all the time. All right, so my assistant producer has to come banging on the window telling me, hey, come back to the world. Anyway, you know, we've all watched what happened with the arrest of Julian Assange, and we've all watched with, I hope, a certain amount of, you know, horror at the way Assange has been treated, not only by the authorities and by the U.S., but if you look at what the U.S. has got in store for him, if you look at what the British have done to him, and you look at what they're actually going after him for in terms of what he did in relation to Chelsea Manning and the whole thing, the way he broke open a lot of the horrors and the crimes that the U.S. was committing. Back in the war on Iraq and all the rest of this. And when you think of all that, I found an article that was from someone we've had on the show before. His name's Trevor Timm, and I was really interested in hearing what he had to say because the title of the article is Assange's Indictment is Trump's Next Step in His War on Press Freedom. Trevor, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. You know, there's this whole thing. There's this disgusting kind of nitpicking or whatever it is, you know, like just sort of whining about, oh, Julian Assange, he's so disliked, all this other stuff. It's almost like calling on people to forget about Assange. What difference does it make? As long as our butts are clean, what difference does it make? And you make a point that you say to people, please do not fall for this trap. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, anytime our government or any government wants to curtail the rights of all people or all journalists, what are they going to do? They're not going to go after the most popular person in the United States or a legacy media organization like the New York Times. What they're going to do is go after somebody like Julian Assange. I mean, you know, Julian Assange has done many good things as far as publishing goes, and you could argue he's done many bad things. But the crux of the matter is he is fairly unpopular now, and the Trump administration has figured that if they can bring charges against him, maybe the public will react in a positive or neutral way, that they won't see the extreme dangers of prosecuting Assange for his actions in publishing documents with WikiLeaks, and that they can then use that precedent to go after other journalists. We know that the Trump administration obviously hates press freedom. You know, Trump constantly goes on Twitter tirades about the media all the time. But not only that, you know, they have been on pace to prosecute a record number of sources of journalists. He's talked about making it easier to sue journalists for libel, like for stories that he doesn't like, and has even talked to the former FBI director about throwing journalists in jail. And so this Assange indictment, it may actually be the first step in trying to figure out a process for which he can more directly prosecute journalists in the future. And I think that's why, whether or not anybody likes Assange or hates him, that they should be extremely worried about this prosecution.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. It's very heavy because when you're looking at this, it's sort of like they have done already. I mean, picking Assange to, you know, to go in, grab, make all this stuff, all this uproar about it and all this other thing. You know, at the same time, what they're not saying, although, it's sort of as Trump has made it clear that he is furious. And you make this point in your piece that you wrote. Trump has been clear that he's furious about leakers and that the news organizations that publish him ever since. And he's furious with the news organizations as well ever since he took office. And he complains about it, you know, in his Twitter tirades. But he's actually more than complaining. He has actually directed the Justice Department to stop leaks. And he's actually, I think this point that you were making about, look, the door is open to a certain extent for Trump and the people that run the U.S. fascist regimes. What are they going to do? You know, they have the freedom to do certain things on this. They have the freedom to actually make moves that could, you know, if you think about it, the upheaval brought on by that could be very, very important in terms of the existence of a press that's actually telling that's trying to tell the story, trying to tell the truth, and a people who is, you know, informed of what's going on and being able to make choices about what's right and what's wrong.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Donald Trump, as you mentioned, has constantly not just complained about leaks coming from his administration, but has publicly directed the Justice Department to do something about them. And whether or not this administration or any administration likes leaks, the fact of the matter is that leaks are vital to our democracy. You know, the press acts as kind of the safety valve when the checks and balances of our government break down and can bring accountability to issues that otherwise wouldn't see it. And Trump clearly has been preoccupied by leaks for just about as long as he's been in office. And, you know, in some sense, it seems like they're driving him somewhat crazy because he has this hatred for the media. There is an opening now for him to potentially use this WikiLeaks prosecution as kind of a backdoor way into making it easier to prosecute journalists, the New York Times, the Washington Post, or whoever has made him angry on a particular day. And the indictment of Assange, which I think we can get into a little bit soon, you know, thankfully does not make the act of publishing illegal. But what they are essentially trying to do with this indictment is criminalize a lot of news gathering behavior that is common to many journalists. So, for example, using an encrypted chat program, protecting your source's anonymity, or inferring that you need more information or documents from a source, which reporters do all the time. And so it should be quite worrying to all journalists, again, even if you dislike Assange, and even if you don't think Assange himself as a journalist. Just because you don't think that he is a journalist doesn't mean that this precedent can't be used against other journalists too.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get into what you just raised, because, you know, when you're talking about that, I was thinking, yeah, let's jump into this. You know, the part.
Yeah, absolutely. So, the indictment, mm-hmm. You know, I think immediately when it was released, there were a lot of journalists who only read the headline of the Justice Department's press release. And so what the press release essentially said was that Julian Assange is being indicted for a conspiracy to hack. And, you know, naturally a lot of people's reactions to that is, oh, journalists don't hack documents, you know, and this isn't about publishing, so we shouldn't have to worry. And so we can, you know, either ignore this or even celebrate it. But that actually couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, first of all, as far as we know, Julian Assange did not actually hack anything. The charge itself is fairly weak. What happened was that, at least if you were to believe what the Justice Department says, which I think we should all take with a grain of salt anyways, is that Chelsea Manning was trying to break some sort of password back in 2010 when she had already given hundreds of thousands of documents to WikiLeaks. She had passed along the what's known as a hash of this password to Assange, and Assange said something like, I'll look into it. And the Justice Department doesn't even allege at all that he ever broke the password. They also don't allege that this was even meant to be used to gain access to more documents. Chelsea Manning had already sent him most of the documents that she had, and it was really just about protecting her anonymity. But the real problem with this indictment is not necessarily just that charge, but basically everything that is written around it. Instead of just focusing on this one act between Chelsea and Assange, what they do is then bring in all of this other normal journalist source communication rituals that that any journalist would recognize as something as part of their job. So the Justice Department claims it's part of the conspiracy that they were using an encrypted chat messenger. This is something that journalists use all the time. I mean, Signal, the text messaging application, is pretty much standard practice for journalists these days. And then they talk about how Assange wanted to redact the name, the usernames, and any identifying material in the documents that could lead back to Chelsea. Now, of course, journalists protect sources' anonymities all the time as well. If you want people to come forward, you're going to have to protect their anonymity, especially when they're facing retribution like Chelsea Manning did. And then there is the question of the Justice Department saying that Assange was furthering this conspiracy by not even directly asking, but suggesting or inferring that he would like more documents from Chelsea Manning. And, you know, as any reporter worth their salt knows, oftentimes you can't just wait for things to magically fall in your lap. If you're talking with a source who's given you more information, you may need to go back for clarification. You may need to go back and ask if they have any more material. And it's these types of things that are wrapped around this conspiracy charge that could potentially criminalize a lot of news gathering practices by journalists. And it just is another indication that, you know, the Justice Department probably wants to go after Assange because they know that a lot of journalists don't relate to him and may have negative feelings about him. And so they expect that they won't push back hard against this. And my warning to them would be, you should push back on this as hard as you possibly can, as if it was your own colleague or it was yourself, because it's not your colleague now, but your colleague may be next.
Mm-hmm. You know, as you're saying that, I really, you know, you were starting to get into what I wanted to wrap up with. And I think we still should explore it a little because, you know, when you're talking about this and you report that CNN has already reported that the Justice Department expects to bring more charges against Assange, and that's coupled with the fact that there was an ominous reference to the Espionage Act in the current indictment, and this all suggests prosecutors might still be thinking about charging him for crimes involving the act of publishing too. A Rubicon that would be an absolute disaster for reporters everywhere, not to mention all the people who depend on actually having some semblance of truth in the news somewhere. So let's talk about that. We have a few minutes to talk about that now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this was the real fear of press freedom advocates, you know, that they were going to charge Julian Assange for the act of publishing under the Espionage Act. And that's why a lot of reporters, you know, sort of breathed a sigh of relief when this indictment came down. But that actually might be all part of this plan. When you read the indictment closely, they make this really bizarre citation to the Espionage Act that does not need to be there. And if you read the sentence carefully, it certainly sounds like that they may be preparing other charges that actually might directly go after that particular aspect. And that would be an absolute disaster. You know, there is no story about national security or foreign policy in the last 40 years that appeared on a front page of a newspaper that did not contain classified information. The First Amendment should protect reporters against prosecution for publishing this type of material. And every single newspaper in the entire country publishes classified information all the time. In that respect, WikiLeaks and say the New York Times are no different at all. And the New York Times lawyers would admit the same thing. And so that is another really concerning aspect of this. You know, maybe they were just bringing this one charge so that they can get the extradition process going. And then later along the line, they're going to bring up even more dangerous charges, because for all of the energy and resources that they have put into getting Julian Assange, the one charge that they have brought so far is incredibly weak, even if you take away all of the press freedom concerns. And so you have to wonder, you know, what are the other charges they're potentially going to bring against Assange, and how much more dangerous might they be?
Mm-hmm. All right, Trevor, thank you very much for joining us today, and we'll stay in touch so we can keep following this. All right?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
All right, sure. Take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Trevor Timm, co-founder and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. He's a journalist, activist, and lawyer, and he's been talking with us about the indictment of Julian Assange and the next dangerous steps in Trump's war on the press. And I'm telling you, folks, this is incredibly important. Both the sections that we played today, actually every aspect of the show today was incredibly important. And even as it was unfolding, it became even more evident to me how important this is. And we cannot sit back and just allow things to roll past us without actually taking it all very seriously and acting accordingly. Okay. And I want to thank my engineer today, Teddy Robinson. Hey, Teddy, just a great job again. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with a little piece I really love, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Y como dice Rubén, un carro pasa muy despacito por la avenida. No tiene marca, pero todos saben que es policía. Cuidado con las armas de Brixton.
America.